kick off the show. This is Project JFK CSI Dallas presenting The Journey, a monthly meeting. This is number 4 in the series since we started this. And I'm David Knight. This is Casey Quinlan and Brian Edwards. We're the directors of Project JFK CSI Dallas. And I want to thank everybody for signing up for your free ticket today and attending. I'm sure we'll have some more people coming in as we go along. Today's meeting is basically going to be kind of a free-for-all. The key speakers I had lined up, scheduling conflicts happen, and it's going to happen. But I want to talk about the conference that's going to be happening in 2 weeks. It's going to be a hybrid virtual conference, and also for some students that were getting involved with this. They're going to be on a remote learning classroom here in Johnson County, Kansas. With David Denton's group out of Olney, Illinois. So let's go ahead and let me click screen share here, and we'll talk about what's on the website here. Okay, let's see. If you guys go to the events tab and you scroll down past where you got your ticket out for today's show. The new flyer is up for the Turbulent 60s, the Assassination of JFK, RFK, and MLK, a global virtual conference hosted on Zoom. It's going to be Friday, April 30th, Saturday, May 1st, Sunday, May 2nd, between 9 a.m. and 6 p.m. Central Standard Time. Sunday is going to be a little shorter, from 9 a.m. to 3 p.m. Central Standard Time. And the tickets, now if you are a speaker, you do not need to buy a ticket. I will be sending you an email with your login credentials, so you don't have to pay for a ticket. But anybody else that wants to buy one, the ticket prices are $60 plus the processing fee, which is around $4. That Eventbrite charges the ticket price. So it comes out to around $64 for adults. That's for the entire weekend. Ticket prices for students is $40 plus the processing fee, and you'll be able to go right onto the Eventbrite tab, just like you do for these meetings, and purchase your ticket for the conference. There is, of course, limited seating, and depending on how many sales we have happen, we can always open up more seats, but the sooner you can get your ticket, the better for us, so we know how to plan. And let's see. The website will have a list Monday morning of all speakers. This weekend here, I'm getting all confirmations to make sure none of our speakers have backed out on us due to time constraints or other engagements. So the list of speakers and a schedule will be posted on the events tab sometime during the day on Monday or Monday evening. So that way you'll know who's talking and when they're talking. So with that, I'm going to go ahead and stop share. Again, I want to thank everybody that is coming out to our monthly meetings and getting information that most people would have to wait for us to have a conference in order to be able to talk and share ideas. So this is a great platform that, thanks to COVID, we learned how to do things and come together so that way we can do this on a monthly deal. Now, I do want to tell you guys the next Zoom meeting, we're going to have the conference April 30th, and then the monthly Zoom meeting is going to be, let me check my calendar, make sure I got this right. And I'll have this posted on the website Monday, but May the 15th will be the next meeting at 1 o'clock Central Standard Time. And then a special bonus, Dr. John Newman is going to be at the conference, but him and Alan Dale are going to do about a 30 to 45 minute Q&A, kind of an update on what they're working on. But I'm working with Dr. John Newman on May 29th. It will be a free event. It will be a second Journey meeting, and it's going to be based solely around his presentation, which he may go for two and a half hours. but we're working on doing that on May 29th. It will be free to attend as that as well on that. And then going forward, each month, we're going to have one live meeting like what we do, like we've done the last four times here. And then 2 weeks after that, they will either be a live presentation by one speaker with Q&A, or there will be a pre-recorded journey meeting that instead of having to log into Zoom, you'll just go to the website, click on the events tab, and the video will show up at 1 o'clock on Saturday, just like if you were, you know, attending live, except it'll just be pre-recorded that I'll do throughout the month. But each month we will focus on one key speaker. If you guys are interested, anybody out there that would be interested in doing that, email me at projectjfk@yahoo.com, and I will work in. Like I say, we're only going to do one a month, so you know, we'll have the live meeting, and then we'll have the meeting that will be focused strictly on one researcher and their work and whatever they want to talk about. So with that, I'm going to now turn the meeting over to you guys. I want to talk to Larry Snapp and get him to give us his update. So Larry, go ahead and take it away, buddy.
Okay, thanks. Am I going to be able to do a screen share?
Yeah, if you go to the bottom there and click the screen share arrow, okay, you can share your screen.
I'll do that in a second. So I wanted to give you an update on where we are with our – we have a little band of lawyers that meet every Friday strategizing about what we're going to do about the JFK Records Act. So first, I sent a second letter to the Senate. So the first letter was sent to Carolyn Maloney and also to her, to the counsel for the House Oversight Committee. This past Monday, I sent a letter to the Senate Judiciary, the Senate Homeland Committee, which has the jurisdiction over the JFK Act, to the two chairs, as well as to the two senators who had drafted the resolution in 2017 asking for release of all the records. That's Grassley and Leahy. And then, of course, to Schumer, who is in charge of the Senate and also my senator. So we did that. And then Jeff Morley has a piece coming out on Monday in Just Security, which is going to be talking about both this and the status of the records. We have been in touch with this, with NARA, and probably not surprising to many of you, COVID has really wreaked havoc with the government agencies, and NARA in particular. They have a large backlog of stuff. They're very aware of, so there's two deadlines. There was April 26th for agencies to inform NARA. We call that the SORF deadline. That's a deadline for agencies to let NARA know if they're going to request further postponement. If they don't say anything, the records are going to be released. And then the hard deadline, quote unquote hard, because it's not in statute, it was simply by executive order, is October 26th. Several of the agencies have requested an extension on the April 26th date because of the COVID delays they've incurred. People aren't in the office. They don't have a chance to read, to review paper files. The CIA has been silent, which has been taken as they're basically rubbing their nose on the process. So we anticipate that there may be slippage. There's going to be slippage on the April 26th date. It's too early to predict about October, but we have some things we're going to be talking about. I'll be talking about that are going to try to bring that to the attention. The other thing that we have done is, and let me show you what this is. Let's see. I'm trying to find my, here we go. So what I'm showing you is the website for the Public Interest Declassification Board. This is a independent agency that provides advice to the president about declassification. and they have monthly meetings. We have been in touch with the chair of that committee, and we are requesting that the status of the JFK Records Act be on the agenda for the next public meeting, which is scheduled for mid-May. We don't have a date yet. We're going to write a letter to the board. We've spoken to the chairman of the board. He's all in on this. He's a supporter, but there's a board that has to vote. So they apparently, this was on their agenda, their internal agenda, this past week. We're going to send a letter requesting that they put this on the agenda. We're going to have a lot of the usual suspects sign the letter. But this is one thing I want to talk to you, David, about. We want to set up something so that people can do a Me Too. In other words, the letter is posted and people, and so this is the, if you go to National Archives, you can see this is where the website is. But what we want to do is be able to set up a system that we can, the letter goes in and then people can say, go to your website or Jeff Morley's website and basically add their name as a signatory to the letter.
Okay.
So I guess we'll have to talk about that offline as to whether how doable that is. I don't know if we can, if we would have to basically just collect the names from, say, your website and then send another letter to the PIDB showing here's all the people that are interested in this, or whether we can directly send it through this website. I don't know. We have to figure that out. But this is a big thing because they have public hearings. And actually, in the prior public hearings, the JFK, there's been requests, people have requested for this agency to make a public position about it, but it hasn't been on the agenda. People have asked, you know, and they're at the meeting, they ask about it, but it's not on the agenda, so there's no formal discussion of it. So we're trying to get this. The idea that we want to do is build a public media and political pressure to make it too difficult for the agencies to further delay this. So now that the letter, the Jeff Morley's article is coming out on Monday, I'm going to be contacting Congresswoman Maloney, who's the chair of the House Oversight Committee. I'll be contacting her chief of staff over the weekend to let her know this article's coming out, and suggest she may want to get ahead of it. She's going to be in a primary battle. Her primary opponent is 27 years old. She's another AOC type person. Maloney's been in office 1 year old. Maloney's been in office 28 years. And the person that's running against her is 27. So I'm going to be suggesting to Maloney that half her district is the old John Lindsay, what we call the silk stocking, the Republican, liberal Republican district. And she needs those votes to get to offset the votes of the young progressives in Queens. So I'm going to suggest that this is part of, she can mobilize the older liberal Republican portion of her base by coming across as being very in favor of transparency and transforming classification. So that's the next public thing we're going to try to do and keep tuned. As soon as we get the letter, we're actually probably going to get the letter. How do we unshare this, David?
You'll click at the very top there. It'll say unshare.
Stop share. Okay.
Yeah, there you go.
Okay. So as soon as we get the letter, and we're planning on sending the letter out this week. The lawyers basically have kind of the concept when each person's doing different things. So we're going to be getting the letter out this week to the board. And once we get it to there, then I'll talk to you about what the best way is to get garner support, because we're going to get guys, you know, we're going to get the usual suspects like Blakely, and Judge Thunheim has already said he'll sign. So we're going to get some of the big shots, but we also want to show this broad support for this.
Sure, absolutely.
Right? So we'll figure something out. So that's the sort of the media side right now. We've been doing legal research on what our options are. There was a bad decision that Edwin Lopez got in 2018. He was trying to release get records released of his own report that was still partially classified. But we are pretty sure that we have a right. So the JFK Act doesn't have an express right of a private person to bring an action to enforce it. Doesn't mean that it's not, it can't, that a private person doesn't have that right, but there is a notion of implied right of private action. But several courts in the D.C. Circuit and in the courts that, for the District of Columbia courts, have said there's no private right of action. That has not been the holding there's been one holding in the circuit that deals with Boston, but the rest of the country hasn't been. They haven't had those decisions. So that decision is not binding on other courts in other parts of the country. But that being said, we have the writ of mandamus, I think, is the best option for us. So we're going to continue to press on the public relations media front. And if we don't get much progress, then we're going to go to this writ of mandamus action. And what we're basically going to be asking is, we're going to kind of piggyback on what happened last during the Trump administration. There were many lawsuits filed against Donald Trump trying to overturn executive orders that he issued. And essentially what he did with the JFK Records Act is issue an executive order. So the statute only had a 2017 deadline, right? But there was no deadline, no other statutory deadline beyond that. So he just went ahead and extended it for 4 years, didn't comply with the requirements of the law, and just did this. And so what we're going to do, if we do file a lawsuit, we're going to probably file one against the President of the United States, asking the court to review his executive order, which they have done in the last 4 years, and also sue NARA as a friendly lawsuit, because NARA wants this to be done. So that's probably going to be the likely, and unlike a private right of action, where, in other words, if you don't have the right to bring an action, you can't even get into court, any aggrieved citizen, in this case, could bring this lawsuit. So we'll probably bring it on behalf of lots of people that are researchers. But that's something we'll be doing probably over the summer if we don't get suitable responses from either Congress or, through what we're hoping for is that the PIDV hearing will put pressure on the administration to start doing something about releasing these records, or at least the agencies agreeing to that. Next week, I'm going to also be writing a letter to the Attorney General. The Attorney General can't really sue the President, and the Attorney General can't actually force Congress to take action. Congress has the right of oversight, but I'm going to ask the Attorney General to render an opinion about the action that was taken. That could be another way, and that we're just trying to find different, it's like being an acupuncturist, you're trying to find the pressure point. So we have a team of lawyers that are focusing on these different issues, and we're hoping that we don't have to go to litigation, but if we do, we're prepared to do that. So for this group, the next step's going to be the letter to the PIDV. And I see Bill has joined. Do you have anything you'd like to add?
I'm just pleased that we got such a good working group of people that know the importance of working the media side as well as the legal side. So we've got a good inside-outside strategy, I would say.
Right. So this group, the thing that you guys can help us with and other groups as well, is when we get the letter to the PIDV to basically do your Me Toos. And maybe what we'll do is set it up so that you just have to like add your name, and we'll figure out a way that they can see that there's this massive interest in this. And what technically the PIDB does is they have hearings and then they make recommendations to the president. So hopefully it's not like a binding situation, but what we're trying to do, this is part of our media approach. Bill, is there anything else that we should be sharing? It, I don't think so, right?
The only thing I would add is that at some point we're probably going to write the executive branch directly and remind them of their duty, you know, to do the right thing here, and that Trump actually kind of punted to them, and we think that was not proper or legal. But in any case, it can be resolved by, you know, releasing these records now.
By the way, Bill, I spoke to John Orr this morning.
Good, good.
And when I spoke to him, his first answer was, well, are you thinking about filing a mandamus action?
As a gentle guy, it shows we're on the right track.
Yeah, he clarified that the, well, I guess he buys into the unitary executive theory. So he doesn't think that the Attorney General can actually sue the president, but they certainly can issue an opinion.
That's right. That's all we need.
Yeah.
I think that's it. That was a good presentation, Larry.
Anyone have any questions? I know we kind of, some of this was legally gobbledygook. So, you know, there's issues about the branches, whether they can, you know, we have separate equal branches, but the courts do have the ability to review executive action. That's pretty clear. We're probably going to do venue shopping to figure out which court's the best one to go to. Like the Ninth Circuit used to really love overturning Trump executive orders. So that might be a place to go, or New York. But the other thing is, if any of you have senators that are sitting on the Committee on Homeland Security, you should contact them. Tell them that you want this. You want them to have the hearings held. So if the chairs don't want to act, maybe the members could ask them to act. And if you're also, if you live in Iowa or Vermont, Grassley and Leahy are senators there. So if you have any senators or know people that have senators that are on the Homeland Committee, please ask them to urge the chairs of the committee to hold oversight hearing.
Hey, Larry, maybe you could actually get us a list of who and what state that we can have people contact. We can put that up on the blog post on the website. And
okay.
That would be, you know, the people that are in that state or they know somebody, they'll go, okay, I need you to write a letter to so-and-so in this state to, you know, get a hold of your senator so that way we can get this going. And I think some people may just not know really where to start to – contact the right person, because we don't contact the right people, we're just spinning our wheels.
Right.
So,
I'll send you the letter to the Senate so you can post it, and then they could just reference that letter, and I'll send you the roster of the senators that are on the Homeland Committee, and their states, and then people could contact. Yeah, some people don't know their senators, you know.
Right.
Yeah.
I think that'd be very helpful, and you know, it would be a good step in the right direction.
And as I said, we've also learned through this process that the NARA online collection is down. This is probably more related to funding and government stuff, you know, funding stuff or just inefficiency. But whatever they put up, the spreadsheet they put up only has 53% of the actual collection that was online. So that's not the stuff that was not online. I'm just talking about the stuff that was online that's now down. The spreadsheet only has 53% of that universe of material. So researchers are really constrained right now because they're only getting to see half of what was up there.
That's good information, Larry. Thank you for that. I would like to talk me and Brian for a second, kind of give you an update on what we're doing with the Dick Russell collection that we got from Baylor. We are, as fast as we can scanned documents we are. But the nice part about it is we're going through documents and files that have been sitting untouched almost, well, basically untouched for at least the last 10 years. And, you know, holding, I mean, it's really exciting to be able to actually sit there and pull out a newspaper that was dated 1964. That's where you can actually read it. It's in good condition. You can read the articles. And I know we spent some time reading things as we're scanning stuff in, but, just want to let you guys know we are still working on that. How many boxes do we have, Brian, at your place?
I've lost count of 60 or 70 boxes with two of the large legal size hard case boxes inside it, and they're stuffed. In fact, the box I just finished had 20 folders in it. And that's an average. They're this thick. This is an average folder it's that thick with everything that Dick collected over the years, newspaper articles, interviews, CIA, FBI documents. I mean, he's got a collection and a half, and it's a laborious process, as anybody who's ever scanned, you know, have take staples out, put them together, scan it, put the staples back in, go to the next folder. Yeah, it's going to take a while. But what the good part was Mary Goolsby at Baylor, the chief archivist, wants us to do Penn Jones's entire collection and Jack White's collection, which is a lot of media. We're going to try to get that. If she lets us do that, we'll have to convert those to DVDs, but we'll put those on the website. And John Armstrong's collection, which is available online now, but there's apparently hundreds of file folders that they don't put on, they haven't put on their website at Baylor. So we're getting into a cobweb of scan, you know, sleep scan kind of process, but it's going to get done hopefully with the two of us doing it a couple hours a night and on the weekends. It's going to be real interesting to see if we got enough room to put that on our website. We may have to get a bigger website. Oh, anyway, that's what we're working on.
Did you guys, with respect to the whole gift business, was there any problems with Mary Goolsby, or is she very cooperative?
Oh, she's real cooperative. Yeah, she's
real cooperative.
Yeah, she's great. She's just happy that somebody's doing it, because it sat down there. Dick Russell's collection sat down there for 8 or 10 years, and nobody even looked at it, and nobody could access it because it hadn't even been scanned. So Dick's excited, Mary's excited, Baylor's excited, we're excited. So we're hoping to, when we get it all done, everybody.
And we're excited.
Yeah, I got a question, Brian.
Yeah.
My question is, my problem using John Armstrong, Penn Jones's material currently is that it takes forever to even call up one document. And it's just a messy, unwieldy system.
Yeah.
Will that be streamlined after your work, or how is that going to?
Well, we're hoping, what we do is Mary sent us, sent David and I a terabyte hard drive to put
They're 4 terabytes each.
It's what?
They're 4 terabyte hard drives.
4 terabytes, even more. Mm-hmm. So once we get about halfway full, we're going to send them back, and she's going to dump them onto their website, but we're also going to put them on our website, aren't we not, David?
Yeah, and what we're going to do, I can't speak for Baylor how they're going to do the search engine for their website.
Right.
A lot of the problems that you run into is, and this is the whole idea that I had when we started this project, before we started it, was to try to make it more accessible. I mean, you go to some, like, let's just say you go to Weisberg's site, and you type in a particular search word or search name, you will pull up thousands upon thousands of documents. You can't really, I mean, unless you want to go through every one of them, you can't really find what you're looking for.
No, you got to use 2 or 3 words generally.
Right. So what I'm looking at doing is trying to do a 4 to even a 6-step keyword search. So that way, when you go into it, you're able to, you'll type in Oswald. Well, it'll bring up the first set of documents. it'll bring up another search box. You'll be able to type in a particular thing about Oswald. It'll bring up, it'll narrow that those documents down even further until you finally get down to where you have your meat and potatoes of what you're really looking for. Now, that doesn't mean you can't go through and search the previous documents. I mean, you'll be able to back out each time for how many steps you take. That's part of the algorithm that I'm writing, part of the code, to where you can actually, you know, get what you're wanting without having to search through, you know, something about, you know, that you're not looking for. So, I can't say how Baylor's going to do theirs. I'm sure they're probably going to keep online to what they've been doing the last, you know, amount of years that they've had their document collections online. But I know what we're going to do is try to streamline it to where you'll be able to get the information in detail, plus you'll be able to get that information a lot faster and a lot quicker.
Yeah, that's just wonderful news. I would just whisper in her ear a friendly word about making her site more accessible, because you're not going to Xerox everything.
No.
You're not going to scan everything.
Well, and I'm looking at one of the file folders, the last one I was working on. Dick was real good about labeling everything. He was real meticulous about putting the name of what's in the folder, which is the right way to go. And the one I'm looking at is Dick Russell's research is the name of the folder, and it says Bay of Pigs, and everything in this folder is related somehow to the Bay of Pigs. I mean, there's interviews he's done, newspaper articles, documents. So hopefully when we put it online, it'll just say Dick Russell Collection or Dick Russell Research, Bay of Pigs. You click on that and you'll get 70, 80 documents.
Do you realize that today is 60 years?
For Bay of Pigs.
Bay of Pigs, that's right, yeah.
Yeah.
Curious you mentioned that.
Yeah.
Also, 70 years since Mickey Mantle first game today.
Got that baseball thing in there, didn't you?
Back there.
Brian, I have a question. Brian,
are
these documents, are you scanning them so they are searchable? The PDFs are searchable? Because that's a whole different ballgame in scanning documents.
These are being scanned in as a TIFF image right now. All the TIFF images will be put into each folder will be put into a PDF. Now, once we have to get everything scanned in first, which is what we're doing because that's what Baylor wants.
Then
they want it in a certain way, and then I'm going to be converting everything over into searchable PDF folders, and that's where the coding and the algorithm will come in to where you'll actually be able to search, you know, like what we want to search it as. So. The first step is get all the boxes, you know, scanned in. Once we have those files, then I'll take those files. Each folder will be converted as a PDF folder that you'll be able to do the search through. But what's nice about, like what Brian was just talking about, is say in box one, folder six, that's strictly Bay of Pigs. That's not really the one it is, but I'm just throwing that out there. You'll be able to search through that folder as the Bay of Pigs. So if there's something you're looking for, keywords, you'll be able to find it that way. And then you'll be able to do the general search where you'll be able to look the entire collection on the website. Go into that search box, and you'll be able to search through any one of those folders that has that particular keyword that you're looking for. It'll pull it out of whatever part of that collection that it's in. So it's being able to not only look at it as a folder by itself, by an image by itself, but also be able to look through the PDF and be able to do all your key search words. So, and I think we're going to go, I was looking at maybe just doing three, what they call a three-depth search. I think we're going to actually increase that to a six-depth search. So you'll be able to go through and search six different times by, you know, you'll put in your main topics of what you're looking for. Let's just say it's, you know, let's say it's Bay of Pigs. And then you want to search what maybe the generals had to say. Maybe LeMay, you know, there's something in there that LeMay had about Bay of Pigs. You'll be able to put that in, and then you'll be able to find anything that he put or what he said in those documents. And granted, we're only going to be able to show what's actually in his collection. So, I mean, just because, you know, we know it's someplace else. If it's not in the Dick Russell collection, obviously it's not going to be searchable. But you'll be able to search a lot easier. And describing it, I've got a PowerPoint I'm working on. So when we get to that point, we'll have a journey meeting, and I'll show everybody exactly how do you search this collection. And it basically would be kind of like a teaching class. Okay, if you want to search this collection, here's the easiest way to do it. Here's your ins and outs. Here's your cliff notes of how to you know, work the system. But I think it'll definitely be a lot easier than like some of the institutions have now. I mean, that was kind of the whole point of doing this, plus getting the stuff done since it's been sitting for so long that nobody's actually tackled it. So
it's taken a little longer because every folder I open to scan, I go, oh, that's interesting. Let me read that. Oh, wait, I'm supposed to be scanning. I forgot. I can't help it. Every folder's got something interesting in it.
So I guess Baylor's viewpoint is that you're basically doing their labor for them.
Right.
And yeah. They're happy to do this.
Right.
This is a good model for other libraries.
Yeah.
Road.
Right.
Well, like I said, she told David that there's things on the website, but there's other things that they don't even post. David, what was she talking about?
Well, what she was talking about is there's certain things, especially like in the Jack White collection. Okay, in the Jack White collection, there's so much that's in media that because of copyright issues, and I would figure under fair use copyright law, you know, we're not putting it out there to sell it. We're putting it there for people to view it. It's the same kind of thing that we hear when we talk about the Sixth Floor Museum down in Dallas. They can show you so many things. You can't have copies of this because, oh, copyright is you know, their big thing that they like to stand behind. And I'm not saying that, you know, they use that just so you can't see it. But my viewpoint is this. If you can see it on – if you can go in and watch movies on YouTube for free, you don't pay for them, they're still up there, and they're up there for, you know, years and years. There's some information that Baylor doesn't feel that they can put up because they don't want to deal with copyright. Hey, if they tell me I got to take it down, fine.
So here's an interesting issue. I noticed when I was going through the ARB memos that there was a number of times when they were trying to determine if something was an assassination record, they actually had someone object, and they overruled it as an assassination record. It was of public interest enough that they actually pressured the alleged how do you pronounce the guy that took the film in this inside the whoever he worked for, I forgot, they tried to assert, and it ended up getting into an agreement with the R. But to the extent that what you're looking at, do you know what you're looking at has been identified as an assassination record? Like, has ARB even seen it? Did ARB see these files?
You got to wonder. I'm not convinced they did. Yeah, I don't think the Warren Commission ever did that.
But that's something, Bill, that we should think about in the future as to whether...
We should follow the history of the Allier film. I think that would be absolutely fascinating. Warren Commission knew about it, and I think they turned their head away. They didn't want to see it.
But I'm thinking... from a legal standpoint, that's another thing. Once you get past what we're doing now, there may be a basis to try to argue these copyrights. The copyrights are preempted by the fact they're assassination records.
Well, another thing that not only are we working on, I'm excited about getting the Dick Russell collection done, obviously, so we can move on to the next one, but. The point is there's so much stuff that, like Mary was telling us that, you know, they take, the way she basically described it was, they look at documents and go, okay, well, this is important, we'll put this up. Well, we're not going to put this up. When it comes to, like, Armstrong's collection or, you know, Jack White's, there's so much stuff that's just not digitized. They don't either have the money to do it with, they don't have the manpower to do it, so you get a portion of the collection put up, but the other portion is, we'll come down to the library and go through the boxes and see what you're looking for. When it comes to the Dick Russell collection and the collections that Project JFK is going to take on for projects, we're doing the entire collection. Whatever we can get our hands on, it's getting digitized or it's going to be transferred into a digital file like the media. Videos, audio collections, same thing we're working with J. Gary Shaw on. you know, we're going back even to some of the phone calls that he had that are on old audio cassettes. Now, some of them, because audio cassettes are notorious for, you know, magnetization and demagnetization, they're a little bit more difficult to clean up, but I'm working on whatever I can get my hands on. I feel that everything, no matter if it's one piece of paper, 1,000 pieces of paper, and, you know, collections of videos, it's all important. And we should be able to see whatever is available in that collection. So I take it on a different aspect of, if it's in the box, it's getting scanned. If we're getting our hands on it, it's getting scanned.
So have you gotten a so on the Jack White files, for example, I know you haven't looked at them yet, but do you get a sense that she's not going to let you scan stuff that they fear has copyright issues?
No. She said that, you know, we are more than welcome to take everything that's in the collection and digitize and scan everything that's there, whether they have it up or not. I feel that once we get it digitized and scanned, of course, they're going to receive copies of it. We're going to keep copies of it here. But they may decide, okay, well, it's been so long, or, you know, Prodigy FK's got it up on their website, we'll go ahead and add it to our collection. And it also depends on a lot of disk space, too. I know I was talking to Brian, you know, a couple months back. I said, even if we have to get a piggyback site that will hold nothing but just our documents, then we'll go with that.
I'm thinking about, so they're not going to be concerned, or they haven't indicated to you any concern that by giving you copyright material, they fear it's copyright material and you're going to be scanning it, they're not going to be held liable for a copyright infringement.
Right.
And then they ask for any release or anything from you, like, sort of to protect them, right?
Right. Basically, I think what it's going to come down to is it's going to kind of fall back on us to scan and digitize.
Right.
And like I say, the simple fact that it is, we put it up on the website. If we get a cease and desist letter, we'll look at the aspect of taking it down at that point.
Right.
But if we don't receive that, then it's going to be up on the website. You know, I look this way here. I know every time you upload a YouTube video, you know, there may be some little thing that pops up that says, you know, something in here has been copyrighted. Just because YouTube puts it up there doesn't mean that, you know, it comes down immediately. It's whoever actually owned that copyright. If they want to bitch enough about it,
right,
and tell you have to take it down, it's on them to do it. YouTube can't make you take it down, just like on our website. Our website, that's one thing about prodigyfk.com. We don't have any type of, you know, ads or, you know, owned by anybody else, or their stuff is on our site. We own it. It's ours. We host it. We may not own it, but we own a lot of the stuff that's on our website. But when it comes to these collections, we don't own them. What we're doing is putting them out there for public usage and consumption, and, you know, we're not charging for it. So at that point, when you look at that, they're like, okay, well, you're not taking this copyright work and trying to sell it and make a profit off of it. It's an educational historical website. So with that, I think we may have a few things that may come up over the years, but, you know, I'm not looking for too much. And
I could see the argument on both sides, depending on, you know. But you're not charging for it, so it should be like Casey teaching in the class.
Yeah, you know? Or going to a library and, you know, looking at the materials in the library. You're just being able to look at it.
You could say that, you know, they could say, well, these people would normally be paying me royalties to look at this. So, but we'll see when it comes. We'll figure it out.
Yeah, we'll cross that bridge when we come to it. Hope we don't burn the damn thing down. I do want to give another update. I know that I've been getting emails, and I want to let everybody know right now. Yes, the videos from the conference in November, they have been late getting out. I've got quite a few of them done. They're not 100% done, so that's why they have not been released. But between divorce, moving, these monthly shows, scanning, you know, hundreds of thousands of documents, the videos will come out. I'm hoping to get them out here within the next few weeks. And I do apologize to everybody that we haven't gotten those videos out yet. I know I have gotten some emails, and just hang in there with me and we'll get them done. So you'll have your hands on them as soon as possible. Let's see here.
Well, I wanted to point out a couple things that I know within the past couple of years, and I have not been directly involved in this, but David and Brian have. they've gone to the Dallas Public Library as well as the Dallas Police Archives and have gotten access to material there that we didn't even know existed.
Wow.
And those are other available areas that we're looking into with the possibility of maybe sharing. I'm not sure if they'll let us scan anything down there, but at the same time, they've opened up, the archivists have opened up some things that, my God, we didn't even know they were available. So, and that's in Dallas, but I think David or Brian can at least talk to that just a little bit.
Well, I know when me and Brian went down to the Dallas Public Library, we asked for certain things, and we happened to meet Clayton Ogilvie. And Clayton is the guy that digitized the Weisberg collection. Now, we didn't know each other, had never met. I didn't even know who digitized the Weisberg collection. But he overheard us at the library sitting down, you know, making scans and going through microfilm. And he goes, well, I'm Clayton Ogilvie. He introduced himself, told us who he was. And he said, I'm going to be in Lawrence, Kansas, which happens to be where Brian's at. So, you know, Rothschild Jayhawk. We're going to be there. I'm going to be there this week to do some more digitizing stuff. That's why I'm down here this week working at the library. And he wound up giving us the entire Weisberg collection on a hard drive to make a copy of, which made it a whole lot easier than having to go through and download all those files off the website.
Yeah.
And I tell you what, it's guys like that that just happens to, you know, say, hey, this is what I'm here for. Well, once the two of us the three of us got together and started talking to the library, then we asked them, well, what else do you have in the back room? Because we really didn't know what their collection was. Now, they didn't show us the back room other than to let us know that the back room was chock full of stuff that, you know, probably the American public has not seen, you know, in 50 years. We were able to get, we were able to take photographs of these hand-drawn drawings from the Ruby trial, some in black and white, some in full color, that we're just sitting there in amazement. I mean, these things take up, you know, a tabletop. They had to lay them on the floor so we could actually stand above with a DSLR camera and take photographs of them. And some of those things are already on the website now. We plan on making several trips until we can, you know, we asked, you know, the library, and I know when I was at Kappa speaking in 2018, one of the ladies from the Dallas Public Library was on the panel with me, and she saw what we were getting ready to do. This is before we got the Dick Russell collection, and she said, you guys really need to, you know, do our collection because we just don't have the time, the manpower, the money to do it. So, you know, we're looking at that as another place to, you know, to start going through their archives. You know, they don't have anything posted online. If you want to see it, you have to go down there. They bring out the boxes and you just start going through it. You're able to make copies of anything that they have, or you can take photographs of anything that they have. So that's kind of where me and Brian are looking, going, okay, when we go down to Gary's house to work on his collection, we'll spend a day at the library while we're down there to go through stuff. So
that was part of the reason that we put that panel together, was to not only have the attendees hear what the collections were, but to have the Marys of the world and stuff see that we're here and we want to do something with their collections. So that was good that opened up some doors for you.
Yeah, and like I say, sometimes it's just a simple, you know, the simple phone call or just showing up going, hey, you know, we're researchers and this is what we're looking for and how can you help us out? You know, we had kind of an inside track with the library through a fellow researcher, and we took that person with us and went down there, and they basically kind of knew what we were, you know, looking for, and this person had been down there several times going through things. So, you know, it opened up that doorway for us, you know, non-local guys to go in and go, hey, this is what we're here for. And once they start seeing what we're doing and how we're doing it, then more people are wanting to come on board, you know, to be part of, you know, the work that we're doing. So,
well, to give you an example of what David's talking about, stuff that nobody even knew existed until they brought it out of the back room. I'm going to share my screen with you. We found a, let's see if I can do this correctly. A library card or a library notice. Okay, how do I get that?
Click on share screen at the bottom, Brian, and then you'll pull up a window and it'll show what window you want to share.
You have to open up the document before you share screen.
Yeah, it's right. Open.
Okay.
And it says, okay, well, Zoom. There we go.
And the guy that's been scanning everything.
Yeah, right.
Sorry.
Makes you wonder what button.
That's good, Larry.
Thanks, Larry.
Well, you didn't tell us there were Playboy magazines in those things.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we have to censor those. We don't want
that's all I read in the 70s.
We did come across a few of those.
Yeah, so you don't get those.
Well, those were the main place people could publish back then.
So now,
look at that.
Can you see my screen?
Yeah.
Okay, this is an overdue book notice to Oswald. He checked out Arovall.
Yeah, Jim Cobb helped him write that book.
Yeah. It's about they had the actual book. They had a copy of the book. It had to do with communism or
Arovall was kind of like the FDR of Guatemala. And
the
city station hated him. They did dirty tricks on him.
Yeah. But they even have this card that shows that he has an overdue book.
Yeah. Do 1113.
Hey, Brian, pop up on your screen there some of the Ruby trial drawings. You got those on your computer right there?
I think you took those pictures. I don't have those readily available, but I can look for them while we're talking.
Why is Jack Bowen's name on that library card? He was his former worker. Was he like a contact or an address or something for him?
Let me pull it back up. I'm not sure what that was all about.
I think it was he was literally the guy who introduced Oswald to the library.
Hmm.
And he was a mobster, too. He worked with mafia as well as working at the copy shop where they did.
Oh, this what is this? 12. I wonder what 12/7/65.
I think it's when it expired.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and then Jack L. Bowen, I think, was the guy who introduced him to the library, or something like that. It's just a very odd thing.
Wow.
They go that length.
Wonder why they would put
this
that.
Is before computers, you know, they wanted to get the books back.
I guess he'd be the follow up if Oswald didn't turn the book back in.
That's what I think it was.
Is that Oswald's phone number? To the right of the name?
I don't know, Larry. I don't know what that is.
Let's look at it. That's 63. That might be Ruth Payne's phone number. No, extension 212.
Yeah,
We should check that out.
I wonder if that's the depository.
You know, it very well might be. Second floor, right?
RI8.
9071.
RI8.
It's pieces like this that you come across that, you know, when you first see it, you're like, oh, that's kind of cool. But then when you start actually going through and looking at the picture, the document that you find, you know, something that can be this obscure, you know, actually has some information in it that, you know, we can trace down to find out what's in it.
Well, think about the Elizabeth address, for example. That would indicate that he did it, you know, much earlier than when he was working at the depository.
I'm going to experiment here with something. I'm going on to the white pages.
So 50 years ago? 60 years
ago? I want to see where RI...
Eight? Well, I'm sure it's digitized now.
Yeah, I know, but it may... I wonder if it does it. What was the number? RIA what?
9071. With an extension of 212. That, so obviously it's not a house or... could be.
I think it's Jagger's. If I was betting right now, that would be my bet. It's Jagger's. Because Bowen worked at Jagger's. And I think he lived at Elizabeth. I think our friend Brooks LaPlante knows when he lived at Elizabeth.
Wow, no kidding.
That was before...
we need an area code.
That was before area code, right?
Yeah.
Say it again.
That was before area codes were in effect, right?
What's strange is I didn't realize zip codes were in effect in 63.
I just found that drawing I was talking about. Brian, hit stop share on your screen. Let me share this real quick.
That thing is about 3 foot by 2.5, 3 foot by square. Beautifully done.
But yeah, these are things that we found in the archives at Dallas, the Dallas Public Library, that we had never seen before.
It's Patrick Dean there, supposedly. Oh, yeah, they found those archives in the library too.
But yeah, like I say, there's a lot of stuff that we have that we're going to be getting up on the website.
Sorry, can you hear me?
Yeah, go ahead, Mark.
Can you go back three pictures, please?
You want to see that Bill Shelley one?
Hold on, the second one, the next one.
This one?
Two back. There's two pictures of Shelley getting in a car with Bonnie Ray Williams and Denny Hart. Hold on. I just want to see the difference. Oh, there's no difference between them. It's just a different print, isn't it?
No, one's a raw image and the other one's a JPEG image. You can certainly see the photographer.
Okay.
Yeah, let me see if I can. I can't rotate it.
That's a pity. That's okay.
She had boxes of first generation prints.
Really?
From the original negatives down there. I mean,
you need to scan all that in. All
she wouldn't. She wouldn't let us. She'd let us take pictures, but she wouldn't let us do anything else with it. We couldn't even touch it because a technician had to, you know, bring it out, put it on the table. We take a picture. She put it back in the sleeve. Put it back in the box. We didn't even get a chance to touch it.
Yeah, that's some of the things we run into, and like, you know, with some of the stuff we go out and we touch. I mean, we've got the white gloves to put on and all that when we're handling things. But yeah, the Dallas Public Library, there are certain things that they'll allow you to touch, and then when it comes to photographs, you can take photographs of anything, but you're not able to actually handle them.
Will they not scan them in for you?
They will not scan it in for us.
No.
One thing they won't do is you're not allowed to use anything that would put pressure on the item. So you can't put it through. We couldn't feed it through our document scanner. I couldn't put it through the flatbed scanner. Now there were some documents that they could take over to the Xerox machine and make copies, and then we could scan those in. But
take a picture with your.
Well, we could take pictures with the phone, or these are taken with the Sony A6000 DSLR mirrorless camera.
Yeah.
It has a high resolution, and then what I've got to do is go through and crop out the background, and then when I crop it, even though this image looks like it's bent, it'll actually flatten the image out when I get done with it.
So RI is Riverside. That's a downtown exchange.
Oh, I found the exact number, Larry, so you know.
Okay.
It's 1967, Dallas Genealogy Group, and it's the number for a woman named or a man named Leslie Anderson, who's one of the directors of the organization. So I just wonder if they were the ones who preserved the library card.
And White Cliff, Oak Cliff was WH.
And then they actually have photographs that were donated from people that, you know, lived in Dallas at that time that wanted to donate their photographs to the library to have for people to go in and take a look at. So when this is the weekend of the assassination. But like I say, it's going in and taking out the software I've got. I'll be able to go in and crop it, take out the glare of any plastic that might be left on the photograph. And
so you took these pictures with your cell phone?
No, these were taken with my Sony A6000 DSLR digital camera. The mirrorless DSLR. It's got a high resolution to it.
Yeah, that's great. But that's from the luncheon.
Yeah, this was from the luncheon here.
And you can still see that it's in the plastic, too, so.
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah, that's an interesting one right there. I'd never seen that one before. They have all the military represented and put their hats on the gravesite. There at giving tribute or whatever, but they put all their hats on there. That's pretty cool.
On the photograph part of the website, there's going to be a heading that says Dallas Public Library Photographs and Dallas Public Library Scans, and everything that we took from Dallas will be going in that album on the website. So the things I'm showing you now is kind of these are the raw images before I've done anything to them yet. I will tell you a funny story. This photograph was in it was the best quality that we'd ever seen. And they had like 12 of these things in a folder. And I even offered to make a donation to the library so we could obtain one of these photographs. And they told us, no, whatever's in the collection has to stay in the collection. We can't sell anything or give anything away. But I was willing to walk out of there with about $1,000 donation just for that photograph. I would love to have that mounted and put up on the wall. It was just some of the best quality that I'd seen of that photograph.
Bill, you said that phone number that phone number comes back to who?
Leslie Anderson Boykin. I can send it to anybody who wants to see it.
And who do we know who that is or what related?
We know this person was a director at large for the local history and genealogical society. And those people are usually the muckety mucks in town. You know, they were working in combination with the Dallas Public Library. And the RIA is shared by the City Hall and the Police Department, so it's like smack dab downtown.
Yeah, it's downtown number, yeah.
What are your thoughts on why that number would be on that library card?
I think it's worthy of further investigation. That's where I think.
Very suspicious that number, that's is on there.
Now, maybe I keep going to the simple explanation as a genealogical society created the copy of the library clerk card and wanted credit for it. You know, but that might be too simple.
I want to show one quick thing. This is we were walking by, and the librarian, she goes, "You want to see a?" I forgot what they called this. They had actually had a box of stuff that was donated to the library, and this was inside of it. And they have it on display. It's an original. It was like there was like the different colonies at the time got a their own individual, I guess, copy. I don't know the whole story behind it. There was a book. I haven't had time to read it. But this was actually inside one of the boxes that was given to them. They went and had it authenticated. It's an original.
Was it declaration.
This is actually in a glass case.
Okay.
And the oil stain, there's an oil stain on it right here, and you can see where the paper was folded, but this was folded up and was just put in a book.
Wow.
And somebody had it in their attic and just donated it, and when the library saw it, they're thinking, oh, this must be a reprint, and then when they had it authenticated, come to find out it's one of the original papers. It was just really cool to be able to just, you know, go to the library down there and see this firsthand.
I think this is very much like the young lady or the gentleman who went to a yard sale and picked up – he was looking for frames, and he picked up a frame of the Declaration – or no, a frame that he wanted, just a wooden frame. And then when he took the back off, found a folded copy of the Declaration of Independence and didn't think too much about it, then turned it in to authenticate it, and they authenticated it, said it was worth probably about $1.5 million, and he goes, you got to be kidding me.
I've been for a $5 frame, right?
Yeah.
Well, let's see. Who else would like to share something today?
Oh, my God.
Anybody?
Well, one last observation. I looked up 1954 Commerce Street, and it's the address for the Dallas Morning News.
Really?
Yeah, and it's extension 212, so it's probably, you know, it probably might have nothing to do with this Boykin character at all. It may be focused on, rather, whoever was working extension 212, you know, on those days in question. That's really interesting. One of my running theories, which I'm going to present at our next get-together, is that Kent Biffle, who worked for the Dallas Morning News, knew Oswald in 59 and 60 and right through 63 and was there with Allier, the only two reporters who were up on the sixth floor with the cops that day. And so I have always felt that this was an operation, the newspaper people, you can't rule them out just like you can't rule police officers out.
Right.
So I'm looking at a lot of old newspapers between.
We need to get
right now.
We need to get the notes, the digital copies of the notes. Ken Biffle's son needs to be contacted.
He's on the internet. He did an interview with his dad. So once my homework is done, I want to contact his son. That's right.
Because we need to try and get the notes that he took in his booklet while he was inside the Texas School Book Depository.
Yeah.
There's probably gold in there.
Yeah, his son's got a brain in his head. Biffle died a few years ago, so he's probably got all that stuff tucked away. And I think the important thing is, you know, like I would try to do with anybody else, just because this all seems kind of fishy and suspicious to me doesn't mean he's part of the action. But he might have been a piece on the board. He was, by the way, an FBI informant. And that's documented. That'll be part of my story.
Who wasn't?
But an informant is a tool of art, right? You know, I mean, there's sources and there's informants. He's actually described as an informant.
Bill, I was going to share with you real quick. I don't know if I sent this to you, but in the library they had a couple boxes of cop pictures, and this is Westbrook right here. He was a captain at the time of this picture.
Isn't
and
awesome?
Yeah.
That's a great picture. That's probably the best picture we've got of him.
Yeah. And unfortunately, the other picture is a different, same location within seconds of the first one, but a different left, it's in a left or right profile. So you really don't see a full face picture of the guy. And this is all they had. I asked them specifically, I'm looking for Westbrook, pictures of Westbrook in uniform or out of uniform. This is all they had.
Well, that's enough. You know, now we ought to find his pictures of when he was in South Vietnam training the police.
Yeah.
We'd learn
more. Another thing they had down there was some of the Dallas police annuals, like the yearbooks that, you know, Dallas police put out yearbooks kind of like you'd have in high school. And we were able to find photographs of different officers, of their photographs they took to be put in the book. So what's helpful for that is, you know, I'd like to be able to digitize all the books like 5 years before and about 3 or 4 years after the assassination.
Know a lot more about who was in Daily Plaza that day.
Exactly. It's kind of like doing a reverse engineering of, you know, facial recognition, you know, through the photographs, but I'd be able to go back and match that photograph with somebody that's in one of the annuals.
Well, I think reverse engineering is the era we're in. You know, just earlier today, I stumbled across photos of from 1970 of Daily Plaza with and somebody's got pictures of the witnesses and names of the witnesses and where they were standing and all that stuff. This is Richard E. Sprague, who geolocated all that stuff. He was a computer whiz back in the day, and his stuff is in storage at a library. And what I'm trying to say is I think when we nail down the geolocation and the chrono for the witnesses and the newspaper men and the police, we'll have the best possible picture we can have, I think, of what happened that day in many respects.
I'd like to make a comment on that regarding witnesses, if I may. The African American witnesses that were lining the north curb there of Elm Street, if you look at Dan Roberto's witness map, not a single one has ever been identified.
Right.
Not a single African American witness, and there were many there in Dealey Plaza that day, and they were completely ignored. when I interviewed Roy Lewis for my book, he told me that they were completely ignored. In fact, a couple of the documents that they say that they interviewed him, he doesn't remember anything of that. He said that never happened. Okay, so they just went ahead and wrote whatever they wanted, you know, about him. And he told me that, you know, African-American witnesses were completely, completely ignored. And if you look at Dallas at that time, you know, it doesn't take a rocket scientist, you know, to determine why.
No, Larry, and you know what else? I just stumbled across the black witnesses they did not ignore, people like Charlie Gibbons. Who is
to fit the lone nut, of course.
Right. Well, you know what happened? The Secret Service guy and his brother, who was a local cop, leaned on Thayer Waldo, the reporter, and they
of course.
They put themselves out as sources, saying we know for a fact that Charlie Gibbons saw Oswald shooting from the window, and Thayer Waldo, who I think was a good guy, not a bad guy, but he wrote a story.
He had to go to Mexico.
Yeah, and people don't know this story. I mean, Waldo totally got played.
That's
and
right.
Gibbons was totally extorted. I'm not using the word blackmailed for obvious reasons.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
And they made him, that was one of the tools they used early on to mm-hmm. make him do what they wanted. And these are the great stories about, you know, people of color getting leaned on, all the people in the
Fifth Ward. That's right.
Leaned
on. The Bonnie Ray Williams, Norman.
Yeah, all those guys. One of them went on the show in that losing effort that Spence put on and told Spence, I didn't have any chips falling down on my head that day. The FBI made that up.
And Gibbons changed his story about the pack of cigarettes going up there and everything. And he already said that he had seen him on the first floor.
And when they were interviewed by the Warren Commission.
He shouldn't take the heat.
Yeah, and when they were interviewed by the Warren Commission, each one of the black witnesses were asked right in the beginning, either by Dulles or Ford, have you ever been in trouble with law enforcement before?
Yeah.
They didn't ask the white witnesses that question.
Yeah, but the ones that were lining the parade route on Elm Street, not a single one has ever been identified, and they can tell a story. You'd have to go to the Baptist churches in Dallas to see if, you know, relatives or descendants, you know, which stories have been passed on, you know, from one generation to another, and that would be the only way because, you know, I doubt any of those are still around.
Sounds like a great research project, though.
Yeah, well, there's the black couple that, you know, I think are still alive who were near the pop bottle that broke in Daly Plaza. And people say
Alice
still scared to come forward. That's my understanding.
Yeah. Emmett Hudson, you know. He said, bullets were flying over my head, you know.
Right. No, you're quite right, Larry. I mean, this is another really ripe area.
Completely, yes.
And we only got 5 or 10 years left to really do the what's left.
Yeah, that's correct.
Yeah.
Bill, I got a question for you. The Criminal Intelligence Division, I get the vibe by going through so many handful of documents that the people of the Texas School Book Depository were closely monitored in the months following the assassination as such.
Well, that would be good police work, actually. That would be the only good police work that was done if they did
Well, be that as it may, there is absolutely very little reporting on this whole thing. Now, a good indicator of the shadowing is Victoria Adams when she spoke with Barry Ernst. And that Lavelle showed up and that he basically used the excuse that her interview that they had a fire at DPD and that her interview was gone up in ashes and therefore needed to re-interview. And then at that date, that's Feb 1764, basically the encounter between her and Stiles and Bill Shelley and Billy Lovelady is basically created in that document for the very first time. And later on, you know, they like ooh-ahing through their Warren Commission testimonies as such. But that basically what she said during her interview was this, that Lavelle came a day after she had moved into that flat. Her name was not on the lease. She had no bills at that point. Her name wasn't registered anywhere with anything. And the only one that's supposed to know that she was coming was the person that she was sharing it with as such. And there's other bits. I don't know what's her name. I just lost it. But she's standing in the middle of the stairs with Maddie Reese and wore a black outfit as well. And in one of the lists, she's coded as being something related with criminal intelligence, or they're looking into it as such. And to me, also, the other stories that I've read about it, it basically shows that they've been doing. But what I'm after is that the files. Now, of course, they can wing it as such that it has nothing to do with the assassination as such. Because when Lavelle was asked why he'd done that interview with Victoria Adams, he basically said he wanted to clear things up for the Ruby trial. So it that's the excuse that he used, basically, and to also insert the Lovelady and Shelley encounter as such. Well, I'm basically thinking about where those documents could be.
I think that's another great question. And I bet you one thing. I bet you a lot of them are actually still alive. And the reason why is because we're talking about several really important sets of files. One of the, is the Red Squad files, of course, which was Revel's beat, pretty much. And then there's the narcotics files. And then there's the organized crime files. Because all three of those vectors came within criminal intelligence. And they cross-index, you know, because a lot of people travel between these different worlds. And Gannaway, you know, is central to all this because he was the head of the entire unit. And you see a smattering of these files, but only the ones, you know, that are directly post-November. But they trickle on into 1967. You see all kinds of fights between the Dallas unit and the FBI.
Oh, yeah.
They're spying on each other.
I'm
going to write about it one of these days. And we're just seeing the top level. The rest of the stuff, they simply haven't turned over. But I don't think they've destroyed most of it. You know, they probably destroyed the hottest documents, but I'm sure if we got a hold of the rest and sifted through it. So, you know, we need, in my opinion, we need a team of people at some point, you know, who are trusted and, you know, vetted, to work specifically in the Dallas-Fort Worth area, because Fort Worth knows a whole bunch of stuff, too.
Oh,
so
yeah.
Does Irving. So does the other towns, you know. And we need to interview these folks, and we need to do a good Public Records Act request, you know, or the equivalent, you know, or get the feds involved to cough up these documents, because they got missed by the ARB for the most part.
For all you know, there could even be still photos floating around somebody's attic, you know?
Yeah, all you got to do is knock on the door and ask. But this is the kind of stuff, you know, that we could do, you know, in small groups, you know, in trusted formations. And that's what I'm urging that we do in the months ahead. You know, not today, not tomorrow, but that's the kind of stuff we ought to think about. Yeah.
Bart, the encounter or the false encounter that you're talking about, in the Texas School Book Depository building, was in the back of the first floor down by the elevator. Is that the one you were talking about? I think both you guys were talking about this.
Encounter is basically, the alleged encounter is on the second floor lunchroom. The first floor is basically as soon as you're on top of the steps. So on top of the steps, that's the first floor. So when you go through the vestibule and you go then into the export hall, the main factory floor of the TSBD, that's the first floor. And what I basically, through the documentation that I'm presenting, is basically that that Oswald gave him the idea of the second floor lunchroom encounter. And that basically at first, that neither Baker nor Bookout and Hostie basically attributed, nor Fritz, attributed to an encounter in the second floor until the next day, the 23rd. And on top of that is that Bookout and Hostie wrote that he was getting a Coke for his lunch, not after. And that was changed over on the 24th by James Bookout, basically swapped the whole context of, and did a 180 on the whole context of that particular encounter. And furthermore, reporting, nobody saw them go in as they claimed they did. I spoke to Roy Lewis as well, through Ed LaDude, who spoke with him 3-4 times. And he said as well, he says, they say that, But he didn't elaborate on it, but he just, in that tone, he said, like, well, yeah, that's what they say, but, you know. And we said, like, that's not what you experienced. He went, no, because he didn't see them go in as quickly as that. Then you've got Molina, who only sees truly go in, not Baker. And then on top of that, you've got Beal Frazier, who stands right in front of the door and also says. And then basically what I did in that paper, and what you're going to know about in big detail, in great detail on the 30th, is that there are way too many contradictions for this story actually to happen. And also there's like a big Building 7 included in there, because it's physical impossible what they claim they did. And Roy Truly is as dodgy as fuck, because he basically gets himself into trouble during his Warren Commission testimony. Gives too much detail away about a so-called thing, whether going upstairs or, and then always ends up with, I don't know. So overall, it's used to make Oswald look like the shooter, because the problem is that by the end of the 22nd, they couldn't nail him for shooting at the president, nor actually put him on the sixth floor at all. So that's why they created the second floor lunchroom encounter, to make it look like he came from upstairs and basically got caught inside the little separate section that was near the lunchroom and the thing.
There was another sighting issue with the girls seeing, maybe with the girls going downstairs and they saw it.
That's Victoria Adams and Sandra Stiles. Yeah,
right. And they claim that they saw some guys, and those guys, you know, then they try to pretend that they were, the timing was all screwed up, but.
Yeah, what happens is actually, everything points to Eddie Piper, that because they said tall black man, that's what they said, because both of them said when they were interviewed by Ernest, like, we didn't meet Shelley and Lovelady, we knew who they were, and we didn't meet them down there. And they said it was a tall black man, and it was also independently confirmed by Sandra Stiles. And that bit is just, they try to discredit her because, of course, she didn't see anyone. So that's a real problem, especially, you know, especially within the time frame. Very noisy stairs, creaky, and, you know, she didn't see anyone. And she was out relatively quick. It would have been, you know, and that's the problem as well after that, because once Adams and Stiles have run down the stairs, their supervisor, Dorothy Garner, walks to the northwest corner where the stairs are. The fourth floor is quite an open spaced area. This is like not like small offices like in on the second floor, for instance. It's just one big space. And also, don't forget, it's a really small, it's not a big area at all. It's what we call it, but it's 30 meters by 30 meters, basically. It's not that, it's 100 feet on each way in a square box, roughly. So it's not that much, especially in an area where there's offices and compartmentalized. But what it is that the woman, Garner, stands in that corner near those stairs, and she hears the girls go downstairs. But on top of that, others who are on that floor are gathering as well. So had the shooter still been in there, they would have gone and go take the, the stairs downstairs, and he would have run into those people on that corner as well. So this all creates a huge problem. And, of course, the Warren Commission does their utmost on basically discrediting Victoria Adams as such. But, you know, the thing is also, there's another thing. What's his name? Williams. Not Bonnie Ray Williams, but the guy who was on the stairs at first. Sorry?
Is it Otis Williams you're talking
yes,
about?
Yes, thank you. Yeah, thank you. Otis Williams went also on the stairs going up to the fourth floor. So he must have been chatting with people, and he also was on the second floor. And this all happened at the very end, at this very moment that the shots had been fired, because you can see him in the Wiegman film, and you can also see him in you can't see him in the Darnell film. And the Darnell film is about 15 seconds after the shooting, when Wiegman shot his footage. So he's already, at that point, he's already going up the stairs to go wherever. And that's another problem. So you have got quite a lot of activity to actually, for Oswald to zigzag his way basically through all these people using the stairs and stuff. So you're talking about three individuals. Plus you've got Eddie Piper. And Eddie Piper don't make any mention about any of that because he was, they try and keep him at the front of it, but he's by others has been identified, especially Forrest Sorrells, that he was hanging out in the back. And the other guy, the other black guy, he was so scared. If you read his testimony, Warren Commission testimony, it's just so obvious that he's just scared to shitless, basically. So.
Well, I tell you, Bart, when your stuff comes out, you know, we can create geochrono locators and do this stuff in real time and illustrate how impossible it may be for Oswald to have taken the stairs.
It is. Yeah. And then, of course, then the first interrogation was part of that as well, because the documentation that was come with that first interrogation, where basically he said that he went to get a Coke for his lunch, and then, of course, also went outside to watch the presidential parade, which was a rare document that I found 2 years ago, just over 2 years ago, and put also host these other notes into perspective. So it's also the reason why I did this whole interrogation thing, because I just wanted to know what was happening and how and when and so forth. And it's taken me 4 years now to do this. And I hope to have it finished in September. So that'll be the third version of it. And but it also interconnects basically with that second floor lens from the car, because that's the bit where they basically could actually try and physically nail him because he was in the vicinity of it. Yet there were other people on the third floor as well. I found a really nice document from Stephen Wilson. If you look at him, it's he's in, actually in the picture that what's the one called who shot that picture of the three guys on the fifth floor? Tom Dillard. So in the Tom Dillard photo, there's you can see somebody seeing on the third floor standing behind blinds. And that's Stephen Wilson as well. And he claims, well, shots came from the west and, you know, never thought they were coming from the from inside the building as such. This is a handwritten, I think a handwritten FBI statement. And he also did an interview with Garrison. And he wrote, of all the people that from a Hoover document, that CE-1361, I think, or 81.
81.
81, where everybody has to answer five questions, and he writes five pages with
bullshit.
Answers.
1381 is bullshit.
Excuse me?
1381 is bullshit. Everything in there is nothing but...
What matters to me is where they are, what they do. I mean, that's what matters to me. I mean, the rest
of it, ridiculous. It's ridiculous. It was done by the FBI, by the way.
Yes, Hoover. Hoover had six questions, and they needed to be answered by every employee as such. So,
you
but,
know,
the second, back, sorry, just getting one back to the second floor. It's physically impossible what they describe, because if you check the photographs, they're at UMT, by the way. Van, you see that it's a very small area. The landing area is incredibly small, and if you read the Warren Commission testimony of Truly and of Baker, then you can just say, like, no way in hell did that happen as such. And on top of that, Truly said that he went ahead of Baker up the stairs. That was actually the first thing that made me say, I want to know more about this, because I don't believe anything about that. Who runs ahead of a copper with his pistol drawn? And with a possible gunman coming down. So I thought, nah, that's not good. So, and there are two or three newspaper articles that basically where Truly says that the policeman walked ahead of him instead of him walking ahead of. This is a Secret Service. This also appears in the Secret Service document in about the 7th of December, 63. And there are more documents where people done by the Secret Service that where there's just a lot of juggling around with the facts. And I'll just say it lightly in that respect. So. Yeah, it's all going to be in huge detail. I'm going to show some videos as well, and some pictures, quite a few pictures, and I've got some really good detailed drawings that Gary Murray gave me. He got them from the archives, and he sent them to me about three, four years ago, and they're very detailed, incredibly detailed. It was shocking to see actually the size of the area that blocks the noise from the landing and the stairs to the corridor to the second floor offices and the second floor lounge room as such. That's so yeah, it's going to be quite a media rich thing, and the same goes with the interrogations. So I tend to do 20 minutes on the second floor lunchroom encounter and 40 on the interrogations, or you know, maybe 35-25, but the interrogations is a bigger story than the second floor lunchroom encounter. Friday at 11 o'clock.
Bart, I was going to point out that not only with you, but with also Brooks LaPlante, and also when you guys present your programs at our conference that's coming up in April and in May, I think that whoever gets an opportunity to pay attention to the meticulousness that you guys have put into this research, even with Larry Rivera's book, once you start to see what, you know, where these things are going to go, I think that there's going to be a cross section in there with Eddie Piper, and I'm not going to say any more about him. But at the same time, Eddie Piper might be a player in this whole situation.
Yeah.
That we haven't even seen yet, and so that's I can't wait to see the congestion and the confusion and the meticulous research that all three of you guys have done.
Eddie Piper had a DUI from 1954. It would not, to me, I mean, a DUI would, after 8-9 years, wouldn't mean as much. But I think back then, I think they could exert a lot of weight and coercion from Eddie Piper in that way. And it's also about how he, you know, if you look at the statements that he makes and his Warren Commission testimony, he basically has to be dragged back in to confirm the whole Baker story as such, but he doesn't do it in real specifics. He says it's rather loosely a law enforcement agency agent of some sort, but there's something fishy about Eddie Piper. That's definitely true, yeah. But will we ever find out? So, you know, I just try to put the whole thing in. So my third paper is Texas School Book Depository, and that will just go on every floor, every person that was inside that building. And then the fourth one is going to be the final, which is going to be Prayer Man, so about the film and so forth. I really hope you get the hands on the Jack White collection. I hope you go for that, because there's a couple of slides that I would really like, incredibly high res.
Well, that's what we're hoping for. I don't know which collection we're going to get after we do the Dick Russell collection. I know we were talking about Armstrong, Penn Jones Jr. and Jack White. I'm kind of actually hoping we get Jack White's before we get the other two, just to see what's in there and you know, get the high resolution scans that we can get photographs and videos.
The slide carousels are, you can view them online. They're there. But the pictures are really small. They're like, I don't know, 900 pixels wide, some crap. So,
well, when I go to do the scanning, I mean, they're going to be 48-bit color, 3200 DPI. I mean, it'll be the best scan that you can possibly get off of it. It'll basically be looking at like you're looking at 6 or 8K.
Yeah, that's cool. That's awesome. I've got the two scans of the backyard photos from Jack White's collection, because he had made some really good Kodachrome reproductions of the prints that he got his hands on.
Mm-hmm.
And they were in Harry Livingston's files. And I got them in as 4K. And that's just the whopper of a shot, basically, to look at quality-wise.
Anything else interesting in Livingston's files?
Oh, yeah, there will be. But that's my next project to work on from next year on.
Bart, I have a question. Are you going to use an artist or an illustrator or a videographer, somebody like that, to try to portray all this marvelous research so people can see it?
Well, first of all, the papers that are going to come out, I hope to make it before the assassination weekend. Otherwise, it's going to be pre-Christmas. I'm going to release all four together, and it means that the first one, which is about the second floor notes from McConaughey, will be updated with about 5 pages. It's about the 7th version. Then the interrogations at this point have about 30 extra pages with a lot of more detail. And so that will be around 340 pages at this point. The other one's about 180, 190. And then for the first time, I'm going to release paper 3 and 4 together with the first two. And the first one is about Texas School Book Depository, and the fourth one's Prayer Math. And they're both leaning around 150 to 200 each. With the Prayer Man thing, I'll just, A, the film material that's available and that's been pursued and so forth, and history and who has this and what happened with that, blah, blah, blah. And the other end is everyone who stood on the steps, basically, who stood where. All the evidence in conjunction with all that, it's all going to be in there, and photos. And then the Texas School Book Depository basically goes via each floor. The occupants of each floor basically identified as such and what they were doing and so forth, and how they come up in documentation and interviews and so forth. So, and then that's it for me. Then Uncle Harry comes. So, and there's a lot of stuff. But that's just what I started up with. And this is also the reason why Malcolm called me and said, do you want to digitize? He went, do you want to digitize a few audio cassettes? And I said, sure, I'll be up for that. Next thing I know, I'm talking 350 cassette tapes later. Video, same thing. I had about 250 VHS tapes from him and from Harry as such. And I digitized almost everything. And those are already online.
So that's the way you Brits talk? A few is like 300?
Yeah, something like that. And then there's, of course, Harry's documentation. But what it is, though, is that it's only part of his collection. It's from roughly the late 80s till 95, something like that, 96 maybe. The majority, the majority is all from him making phone calls and transcribing them. He called everyone. He had assistance of a police officer from Baltimore, and they went into the police computer and they basically figured out where every doctor had moved to and where they lived, and every nurse, and you name it, honor guard, whatever the goal was, they wanted to basically know. So that's going to be an interesting project, but that's all I'm going to talk about there. So, there's a couple of articles in the making. The fingerprints, which is a real enigma, I have to say. And the Minox, I'm going to do something about that as well. And there's one more, but just lost that. But overall, it keeps me busy for the next year or two. And then what I'm going to do as well, to get back to your question, is there's a guy on YouTube called Mark Fenton, and I'm going to copy the idea. But what he does is basically makes anything between 7 and 15-minute tapes, video recordings of a certain aspect of the Second World War, about Germans fighting behind enemy lines, completely locked in, but still resisting till the end of the war in Normandy and all this type of stuff. Really rare small stories. So I'm going to basically chop all my work up and going to put them online as such. So it's going to keep me busy for the next 2 years. Plus, Malcolm's archive needs to be finished this year as well. So, can't say I'm lazy on that one. So, but it's worth it. So.
All right. Well, go ahead, Larry. You got your hand up?
Yeah. Now that I have Bill here, and I'd like to do a little screen share on Mexico City. And I have to say that the number one authority on Mexico City is Bill. And Peter Dale Scott obviously has contributed a lot. But I want to run this by you guys here. This is a organizational chart that I have come up with and based on Mexico City there in November of 1963. And as it goes from top to bottom, and the pseudonyms or cryptonyms that were assigned to each of the players, wow. I want to say that the new Mexico City documents that I've just been poring over for the past two or three years, ever since 2017 when the documents came out, and they just fill out so many pieces of the puzzle and offer new interpretations. But like I said, you have to go back to Bill's book, State Secrets, to, you know, get the primer and then go and look at all these new documents and keep filling in the new information. And what I've come up with here is obviously, you know, McCone, Richard Helms and Kara Macinas, Shackley, you know, Joseph King, Oliver Galvan, you know, his a cryptonym, and Willard Curtis, Wynn Scott. But
I get Larry to send this to us.
I beg your pardon?
I was saying, when you get done, we want to definitely send this to us.
Oh,
yeah,
there we go.
There
yeah.
You go.
Yeah, yeah, good.
Sure. And
if you don't mind, I'd like to put this as a thing that people can go and actually, you know, download your chart here from the meeting, if that's okay with you, Larry.
Sure. No, I have no problem with that at all. You know, I put my stuff out there, you know, for everybody to look at. But from top to bottom, here's what I've come up with. Now that we know that the Mexican presidents were big-time assets and players of the Mexico City scenario there, and even Ambassador Mann, who had worked for the CIA previously with the United Fruit Company, and I have to put him up here, you know, because he was making key decisions, and he was influencing a lot of what was going on there at the time of the, you know, the assassination, that weekend of the assassination. And obviously you've got your good pastor, your John Celso, who was Jack Whitten, you know, and he's chief of Western Hemisphere, you know, which included Mexico, Central America. John Horton was political attaché. Alan White was Scott's top lieutenant there, R.L. Easby. And what this does is it allows you to look at the cables in a totally different light, okay? And as you go down, you Herbert Menel and his wife, who were in the who were doing the Russian affairs there, Robert Shaw, who was a top handler for the Cuban, especially that Cuban infiltrator, that the mole that they had inside the Cuban embassy, Little Mill 9. And you keep on going down, and we get to see who all of the players were in the Lien Boy, which was the wiretapping, the LMT, which was the photographic surveillance, and who was who and who did what. And down here we have this guy that I just can't find who the hell this guy was. Well,
I just emailed it to you.
Oh, you did?
Yeah. Ernest Sickerendos.
You found out who Wallace Roughton was?
Wallace Roughton, yeah. I call it a probable. I really think I got it right. But I sent you the link. It's up on the pseudonyms list now at Mary Farrell.
All right. Well, that'll help me fill out the,
But this is great work you got here. Having them in a box like this is really organized and shows the flow.
Exactly. I think that, you know, with the new documents, we're able to fill this out in a more cohesive and organized manner, you know, and obviously there are more players involved here, but I think these are the major ones. And when you go through all the cables and all the evidence there that from Mexico City, and now with all the new stuff coming out, you know, now we have that Winston Scott had stood as best man to, not Winston Scott, the Mexico Lopez Mateos had stood in as best man for Winston Scott's wedding in 1962. We have the video of that event. We have pictures and everything. And all of the future presidents, Ordaz and Echeverria, were at that wedding party. And they were, I mean, that's how close they were to win Scott, you know. And, I mean, when you got these guys involved in the wiretapping and creating the so-called evidence trail of a Lee Oswald visit to Mexico City, then, you know, it's quite understandable, you know, that they, this, a lot of this stuff was manufactured, you know. So, and I think that Peter Dale Scott goes in the right direction, you know, in questioning a lot of these cables and the evidence, you know, that, that exists today. And it needs to be revisited now with all the new evidence that's come out.
No, this is marvelous work. And I think what we're going to be able to do in the next 10 years is we're going to be the new historians of the emerging era. That stay on the sure footing that people like yourself and Bart and others are doing, you know, we're going to be in that position.
Well, revision, of course.
And if you want to get more information about like the pictures and video of what Larry was talking about with Wynn Scott, that's on your website, isn't it, Larry?
Pictures of the wedding and all the evidence of how close they really were, you know, and actually family, you know, and it's like, and Echeverria was a major, major player in this whole deception, you know. He's the one that liaisoned with the Warren Commission investigators that were sent in April of 64, Coleman, Willens, and Slauson, and he's the one that cherry-picked everything, took them in the direction that Wynn Scott wanted, you know, and you know, hey, you know, it's all wrapped up. We have it here, you know, and that's it. We take this to the Warren Commission, and it's over, you know. And Echeverria was the one whose henchman was the one, Barrios, Gutierrez Barrios, who was the head of the DFS. He's the one who did the interviews of Sylvia Duran and that Nicaraguan guy, Alvarado, who said that he saw Lee receive a $6,500 payment. How he knew how much exactly he was paid, you know, as a payoff, you know, for assassinating Kennedy, you know, and he's the one who led those interrogations.
Yeah, you know? And so you all know that Echeverria became president of Mexico.
Yeah.
Was held responsible for the murder of all the Olympics in 68.
Yeah, the Tlatelolco.
Indicted as a criminal.
Yeah,
and they finally let him go, only pretty much because of his age. He's in his 90s.
Yeah, he's 99, right? He's still alive.
Yeah, I mean, you know, you ought to push him for an interview.
Hey, I've been trying to get Sylvia Duran, and she's protected by the state.
The state of Mexico?
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Oh, yes.
Well, I wonder how she got – you know, we can talk about this later, but the bottom line is, Duran, we do have ways of talking to Duran. I think we could talk about it.
Bob Baer tried to contact her in his follow-up series, you know.
Yeah, and you know who did make contact with her was the fellow who wrote that book a few years ago on the Warren Commission, the one who interviewed
Sheenan?
Yeah, I think it was Sheenan.
Philip Shannon?
No. He wrote a book about 8 years ago, and he interviewed the fella Coleman. He interviewed Coleman before he died and talked about how he met Castro on a boat while the Warren Commission was going on to just get some skinny. It's a really well-written book, but he got an interview with Duran and several of her family members. Isn't it, what's his first name, Shannon's first name?
Phil,
yeah. Phil. That's it. That's the one.
Yeah.
He got an interview with her, so I don't think it's absolutely impossible, and I know somebody who has her contact info.
Because they actually went to her door, Bob Baer. And,
yeah. Well, that was you want to set it up better than that if you can.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, but that's an important discussion I think we should have offline.
Well, let me throw this up here real quick. If you haven't been to Larry Rivera's website and seen what he's got, you can go from the prodigyfk.com, click on the More tab, and you'll see where it says Affiliated Websites. You click on that and just go down to Larry's Space here, and you click on Larry Rivera Research, and it'll pull up all of his, like right here, Mexican presence at the 1962 Winston Scott wedding. So if you want to pull that up and read what he's got on here, Larry's got a lot of great, great information on his website. So again, if
I think the new info on David Morales is just unbelievable. You know, yeah. Some of it, you know, they only released, I think, well, 65 pages, and what's in there is just very, very disturbing.
Whose website, Larry?
That's my blog. That's my blog.
Oh, your blog. You were saying what you've got is disturbing.
No, because I got it from the Morales file, the 65 page, what was left, you know, because, you know, they completely rifled through everything, you know, and got rid of it. You know, I guess Morales had to have had at least 2,000 pages, you know, of documents, you know, in his 201s and whatever. But the little information that was released, it's over there on Mary Farrell, is there. And some of the fitness reports, I mean, he's even called a one-man gang.
He was cross-designated military CIA, and he killed a lot of people.
Yeah. and actually, in this Shackley, the Blonde Ghost that I have here, it is a good book.
Yes, good yes. book. Fascinating stuff in there.
Yeah. Really good book.
And it's really amazing how Shackley didn't know those guys had so much autonomy down in Jamwave. I mean, I mean, Roselli or someone could have plotted something, and those guys never would have known about it.
Yeah, he's with us.
Yeah. You know, it was the autonomy that was put into that, just there was no control.
Well, it looks like we're coming up on the 3 o'clock hour, so I think we've had a lot of good information to share today, and I'm hoping to see everybody at the conference, which is going to be on April 30th, May 1st, and 2nd. Be sure to get your tickets as soon as you can, so that way you've got your spot reserved speakers. You guys will be getting an email from me the last of April with your contact information that shows your meeting ID and password to get in to speak. And other than that, if anybody else has anything they want to share now. Or we're going
to I'm going to post the link to David Morales' files in the box in the stack. Hold on. Before everyone goes. So it's about 100 pages altogether.
Okay.
Hold on.
Yeah, anything that you guys put in the chat log, which is a great place for information, you can go to the events tab, and they're right below the videos. The chat logs that we talk back and forth with, as long as it's not a direct message, you make it to where everybody can see it.
There you go.
You can download the text file, and everything that we talk about during these meetings, you're able to click on those links and
what is this link for? Where is it going? It's a Google
Drive. Google Drive.
It's yours?
Yeah.
Wow.
I see 4 PDFs in the folder.
Yeah.
Huh. David, before we go, I think Brooks has got something he wants to share.
Okay. Yeah, go ahead, Brooks.
Unmute.
Let me see where Brooks is at. Hold on.
Oh, my goodness. Which ball player is that? Mickey?
What?
He's showing us a picture of a ball player. I think it's Mickey Mantle.
That's Mantle. Yeah.
Yeah, that's Mantle.
All right. You're muted, Brooks, but it's a great picture.
Oklahoma boy.
Yes.
Well, Brock, oh, there he is. Okay, here's
got to unmute. Yeah.
Get him unmute.
Now he's got to get his volume up.
Make sure you unmute there at the bottom left corner. We can't hear you yet.
Okay.
I see his mouth moving. I can't hear him.
Yeah, he had the same problem that Gary had last time.
Hey, Brooks, can you hear us?
I think he can hear us, but he can't unmute is my hunch.
Okay, let me put a call into him real quick. Hang on just a second.
So, Bart, you just you put on, what 100 pages of
hey, Morales?
Yeah. Morales? Okay, good.
Okay, I can see you. I just can't hear you. Did you unmute at the bottom left corner?
Me?
No, Brooks.
Okay, sorry.
Okay, can you rejoin? Okay, yeah. Okay. Bear with us just a sec.
You coming back on?
No, we're working on it.
These are the 65 pages that Larry was talking about.
Yeah, I do believe.
Larry at one time was sharing those with me and David Denton, and we were getting into Morales' background, so he was sharing that with us. I'm glad to see some of that online.
But I got a real picture of him there.
Yeah, that's one of the better pictures you're going to see.
Yeah. And a seersucker he's wearing.
You know, what's interesting is in that same set of documents, it's got his wife referred to there, I do believe. It referred to as redacted frail-1. First time I've seen
it. Oh, yeah, I see that, frail-1, yeah.
Yeah, I'm going to look that up. That's a big deal. I know her real name. She was an Irish lass. They had a bunch of kids. She was a spook. I knew that. So I'm not terribly surprised.
That's a weird name, frail.
Yeah, well, you know, she was a secretary. But I don't think she was as frail as all that. I think it was probably a joke. I heard she was tough. You'd have to be tough to marry that guy.
Yeah. Well, were those names automatically generated? Or did they...
No, there was a mix. The pseudonyms, the way I hear it, is the pseudonyms were actually taken from Australian phone books. And, and the cryptonyms, they claim were, and I think they were, sometimes... They were randomly generated, and sometimes they were not. They were
because AmThug was like that's very appropriate.
Sometimes they were repeated. For example, Earhart leaves the station, and who comes in for him takes up the same cryptonym in Mexico City.
No kidding.
Yeah, that's what I found out. Yeah.
You mean when Flick left, somebody else became Earhart?
Exactly. Exactly.
Jesus Christ. I'd love to see the document on that sometime.
Yeah.
Why would they have multiple ones?
Well, it's a good way to throw you somebody off if you think it's still the man.
Yeah.
But you don't.
I wouldn't put it past them. When Flick asked to leave, and that's another thing that you see in all these Mexico City. It was like, you know, rats leaving the ship, you know, a sinking ship right after the assassination. A lot of these guys were sent out of Mexico City, you know, right after the assassination.
Very appropriate term.
Well, I'll tell you, in closing, one of the things I'm really looking for, if I'm going to give me a lead, is I'm looking for manuals or data about intelligence agencies' use of impersonation. In other words, an impersonation manual. You'd think we'd see one at this point. Technical Services Division did that kind of work, you know. I've been combing the internet lately for it, and that stuff is just about vacant.
Well, if they had assassination
people impersonating CIA agents,
if they had assassination manuals, to have impersonation manuals wouldn't be that far off.
Assassination manuals, right? And you think assassinations were shit? Yeah, you see those.
Olson's son, Frank Olson's son, found the exact passage in the assassination manual that said stun him in the head, hit him, in the head, and then dump him out the window, you know?
Yeah. But where's the impersonation manual? That's my question.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, that's probably an ongoing thing, so they're not going to release that.
They do not want to cough that up. That's exactly the point. Yeah. The other reason is it's really fucking crazy for the CIA to do that domestically. And for that, or for the FBI to do it domestically to somebody who's not a criminal. You know?
How did they ever get away with having Jamwave in Miami?
Well, I'll tell you one thing.
It was a forward base. There's nothing wrong with that.
I have a colleague who was an ex-New York City narcotics cop. And he did that for about 20 years. And he told me how they used to do special latex disguises, for certain operations. And that he thought that the individual at the DPD, at the city hall, who's right behind Lee Oswald with the glasses and the Stetson hat, who was identified as ML Hall, in reality was Colby at that time. And he said, it's Colby,
Colby. What's the location again, Larry, this photo?
You have videos of this guy for the weekend of the assassination.
You're saying it was William Colby?
Yeah, he says it's Colby. I did some overlays, and it was inconclusive, but the features are very, very similar. Okay, I couldn't get an exact angle, perspective that I could do digital overlays, but he said, and he's 100% sure that was Colby actually taking the place of this ML Hall. And he went and he found pictures of ML Hall when he was in high school and didn't even look like the guy, So
where's this photo? Is it like the photos of the Texas Rangers with their hats on?
Yeah. And he's the one that's handling, he's right behind Oswald. And he says, if you look closely at some of the videos, he's whispering stuff into Oswald's ear at the same time that he's got him by the arm.
Look at that photo. That would be great to see. Those were the homicide cops. I misspoke. They weren't Texas Rangers.
They were homicide cops.
That was their telltale sign, was the Texas.
That guy there.
Where is it? I got to get it on.
No, I'll tell you. I have a whole file on this guy.
It's this photo? The Jack Ruby photo? Or?
No. I'll show it in a minute. I'll bring it up right now. It's under Ortiz. All right, let me grab the screen here. Screen share. You guys see that?
See a lot of them. We see your index.
Yeah. Okay.
Hold on.
What?
Just
a second. Here we go. This guy here, he's the one that was behind Oswald that entire weekend, okay?
I'm sorry, Larry, which one are you pointing at?
This one, can you see this? The picture I have right up on the screen? It's got two images of Colby and two of the guys.
I'm seeing your index.
The one that says mole?
Yeah.
Can you enlarge that?
This guy right here. Can you see this picture? He's right behind Oswald, this guy.
Which one are you pointing at?
Yeah, we don't know which one you're pointing at. Which row?
Okay, I have it up. Let me get out of here.
Top row, fourth from the right.
Let me put the image up first. Okay. Okay. This one?
Oh.
The guy to the left or the guy to the right?
This guy in the glasses.
To Oswald.
Yeah, I have to say, when I looked at this picture, I'm going, that kind of looks like Colby.
Yeah, that's
But I'm not a Colby expert. I don't take my word for anything.
Can you see that now? I'm
He's going through. He's got body type.
Oh.
You see that?
Yeah.
He tells me that is Colby, 100%. And we ran it through a couple of people who said we're crazy. I mean, he's crazy. You know, that there's no way that Colby was in Vietnam at the time and blah, 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 you know.
They could fly back in hours.
Of course.
Carl Jenkins, for example, worked at it was kind of like O'Hare Airport.
And that's where he's whispering?
Yeah. So,
that guy's pretty gone, and he doesn't, yeah.
Yeah. So, that's what impersonations.
Have you talked to Dennis Morissette? He's the best go-to guy I know on the Dallas Cops.
Yeah. I've corresponded with him.
And what does Dennis think?
No, not on this.
Okay.
Yeah, we did stuff on Love Lady on that because he posted the Love Lady tapes.
Oh. Okay.
Yeah, and we did some stuff on that.
What is his view of Love Lady?
You think he could give us some feedback on this?
Dennis, I think, is the go-to guy on all officers of the Dallas Police Force.
All right, I'm gonna check it out.
Yeah, he's got a site. He's probably got...
Yeah, I know, yeah. I've corresponded with him quite a bit.
Okay, good. Yeah, I recommend his site to everybody. It's wonderful.
Yeah.
What's the site address, Bill?
I don't know it offhand, but if you hit Dennis Morissette, he spells it with one S.
I've got it somewhere. But the Love Lady tapes, we obtained a much, much clearer version of those. He posted one of them. And I had a guy by the name of Carl Gallaudet go to the National Archives, and he was able to digitize all the two tapes of when they went to visit Love Lady in Colorado. And it's quite revealing what's in there.
Hmm.
Yeah. I'll be right back.
I tell you, Brian, Casey, David, this is such a powerful platform. Being able to have these kind of conversations.
Yeah, I mean, this is so much better than once a year meeting. And so much interactive.
Well, I mean, there's been some, there's been other shows that have been around. I won't name them, but there have been other shows around, and they do like a weekly type of thing where they record it and then they put it up on YouTube. And that's great. I'm not knocking that a bit. But by having a live event,
yeah.
Once a month to start with, and now we're going to start going to twice a month. It really opens up a doorway to where we're not having to wait for conference time to show up in order for us to, and usually we've all spoke at the conferences, you get 45, 50 minutes, and you got to hurry up and get it done and get off the stage or away from the screen. Well, by doing it this way, some people that don't have an opportunity or have been locked out where they can't present at some conferences, you can come on here and ask questions, share your research and ideas, and then we're able to really just sit here and hash out the details. So it makes what we're doing, and I've been I get phone calls, emails, and text messages from everybody that attends. And even some that haven't attended, but they've watched the replays on YouTube going, you guys are doing something that, is helping the cause out. And, they've been able to attend to it. And some people may not be able to afford to come to a conference or take a weekend to do it. So they're getting a chance to see it here and then a replay back on the website and on YouTube. So,
Bill, if you get a chance, could you send out his website, because there's some questions I'd like to ask this guy.
Yeah, I'm looking for it on Google as we speak, and I'll give you the spelling of his name.
I'm going to interject something here as a former teacher, probably for about 40 years. One of the things that I tried to bring my students into and up to was my own personal research, and I would bring it in, and I'd show them how I would read a book, what I would look for, what you know, the glossary, indexes, and I showed them all that, the annotated bibliographies, and when I showed them all this material, they had a much more comprehensive view of how a researcher broke things down, and that's what you guys are doing, and that's what I think is really unique about this platform here. Like Bill was saying, you get an opportunity not only inside the state, inside the United States, but around the globe, and looking at the people who have done such meticulous research, and why meticulous research is important to this entire case. So yeah, I totally agree with you, and I think it's a neat thing. And I wish I was still back in the classroom at the high school level.
Well, we'll definitely have to work on it. We'll work on it together, you know, before you do your presentation.
I'm having, you know, oh, here we go. This is what I was looking for. He's got several different sites out there, Dennis does. He's one of the best researchers out there, for my money. And he's got this thing called the JFK Investigators Identification Project, which I'm going to drop into the chat now.
Is that the one where he's got pictures of all the cops and he's got their names?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, to me, it's just like a dream come true.
Yeah.
All right. So I sent it to Brian, and now I'm sending it to everybody. Everyone.
That's bad.
Yeah, you can check out his other work too. Robert Unger's site, by the way. Robin Unger. He's got the best collection of photographs out there, period. So I really recommend his site. And I know in a couple of years, I haven't seen a good list of all the different sites at this point, but people like Robin Unger and Dennis Marsett have done such marvelous work with the photographs. It's just nonpareil, and it's pretty new, because in the last few years, it's just gotten better and better and better.
That's because... because of the internet, and especially about the progress and the releases of certain documentaries in 720 or 1080 pixels. And of course, also people privately giving things, or from the old researchers, managed to get good copies of.
And if I can toot my own horn, if you go to the Mary Farrell, I'll put it right up here for everybody who doesn't go there, but look for the cryptonyms and the pseudonyms sites. Because those give you the names of the officers in the pseudonym side, and the names of you know, agents and sources and what have you on the cryptonym side, and it's a neat little database. That's what I'm trying to say, into itself, because they're intermingled. So if you type in just a name at Mary Farrell, it'll take you right to the crypts and pseudos, and that creates a discrete little database that's kind of the cream of the crop of everything at Mary Farrell. So I highly recommend that tool. Most people don't know how to use that.
And the cryptonym?
Yeah, either the cryptonyms or the pseudonyms.
If you put it
up there, and you just type your word, whether it's Oswald or, you know.
Super.
And we've got Lee Henry Oswald up there now. We've got Harvey Lee Oswald, so you can have fun with that.
We found that even the governor of Puerto Rico had a kryptonym.
That's right. No, I cracked that one. We've had some real fun over there. And, you know, it's a great way to skim off a lot of the dead wood and get to the good stuff.
Oh, I'm going to throw something in a group. I've got a bit of a dilemma. I'm looking for the very first picture that Fred Kaufman shot of Oswald inside Dallas Police, City Hall. Now, I'll tell you where I'm at this point. I can't find the picture. Now, there's an interview with Kaufman on the Sixth Floor Museum's website. And they mess it up by presenting the wrong picture, because the very first picture of Oswald is, of course, the footage when he gets out of the elevator with Gerald Hill as one of them, Charles Truman Walker, the guy with the white police cap on. And they basically escort Oswald from there on into the corridor. And Oswald's got his shirt hanging on his off his right shoulder, such. So it must have been then, because the timing of the very first picture being shot was around 3 o'clock in the afternoon. That's when the Oswald picture came out. Now,
why is it important, Bart? That's an interesting question, but
I wanna know what the first shot, what it actually was, where he was, and so forth. It's from It's part of the pinpoint agenda.
Yes.
And the fact that, like, all the other things I'm dealing with is I sit there with a lot of questions in my head about so many aspects of that particular subject that I'm touching on, even though I've got a wealth of documentation. And, you know, and it boils down many times to evidence just not just disappearing, or, evidence that isn't cataloged properly and handed over to the FBI, who comes up with its own system as such. Malcolm did a big article about this about 22 years ago in the late 90s about the actual police evidence that was transferred onto the FBI as such. And it's an awful mess overall. Malcolm came up with 6 scenarios based on the documentation and the dating of the documentation. It throws the entire thing in disarray. Hydel ID, same thing. There's so many questions about it. I've got just dug up 3 documents of the FBI where, again, they don't acknowledge the receipt of it at all, don't know where it is, then come back with an internal report that the signature, they couldn't figure out whether it was right or wrong or fake. And that the photograph, that the original photograph couldn't be presented as such as well. So it's quite interesting for that matter. But even John Armstrong tried it very hard to get into that. And that whole Hydel ID is terrible. But the Dallas Police evidence, the actual evidence, and the camera that they used, is it called the Recordec camera? It's one of those idiot-proof cameras where you basically put a picture on the ground and just take an image straight for it, and all you do is pull a lever, and that's it. Yet there's over 50 blank images on that particular film. Malcolm took photocopies of every frame that was taken allegedly of the so-called Oswald evidence. So just every time, it doesn't matter what subject I touch, I just remain with so many questions, even though with the extra material. It makes the story more interesting, but at the same time, it's also sometimes very frustrating. So trying to find this picture is just, it's just one of those things, because I've got an article in draft mode, and that's basically the only thing that's missing. So I can just pinpoint and say, well, this is a very first photograph that from Oswald that was sent out over the wire by Associated Press. That's it, basically. But it's that stupid picture that I just need to have so I can finish the demo.
Well, look, a couple questions. Have you seen Robert Unger's site? Have you been there?
Yeah.
What about, I sent to you, I believe, the Richard E. Sprague geolocation for a lot of people. Have you ever seen that before, Bart?
No.
You should get it today. You should have it in your inbox now, actually. It's incredible for finding witnesses, and it's also incredible for finding photographs, because he chronoed photographs from a variety of people in terms of time, which I think might be a big time saver for you.
But sorry, that broke up.
I think those are Dallas photos. Daily Plaza photos. I don't think they'll answer the Kaufman question, but they might. He might have something about Kaufman in there.
Yeah.
Do you see it in your inbox? Can you see your inbox?
Email.
Email. Yeah, the old school.
One sec.
Yeah, I think I sent it to you an hour ago. No, I don't think I did send it to you.
No.
So let me send it to you now. I sent it to somebody else is what I did, and I said I ought to send it to Bert, too. Okay, I'll send it to you now.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Well, an update on Brooks. He was actually going to show Larry a Mickey Mantle autograph, but he's having a few issues with his microphone on his webcam. So we're going to get that fixed for him because he's going to be presenting at the conference in a couple weeks. So I'll make sure that we take care of his microphone and camera issues before that time.
Okay.
But we were just sitting here and me and Casey were talking. And, yeah, I mean, getting the information from you guys and joining together to sit here and talk about things, plus the use of the chat log, you know, so that way people that, you know, didn't attend the meeting are able to watch the meeting, download the chat log, get the information even after the event ends. This is quite the way to, you know, to reach people, you know, in between conference times. So.
Bart, did you get my email? It might take a minute to get across the pond.
Oh, is it that big?
No, I don't think it's that big, actually.
I don't have it.
All right. Well, you should have it in a minute. If you don't get it in half an hour, ping me and I'll send it to you again.
Okay.
All right. Well, is there anything else that anybody else would like to add?
Your email just arrived.
Oh, good.
Hey, there we go.
All right.
See, he added it.
Oh, this I know. Yeah. Okay. Sorry.
Have you seen this one before?
Yeah, I've seen this before.
I'm glad you have, because I would have felt bad if you hadn't.
No, I investigated him quite a bit because of his correspondence, which started at Weisberg's archive. He's quite a lot of correspondence. It didn't end amicably between those two when he came up with that whole dart gun story, and Weisberg took issue with that.
What do you think of Richard E. Sprague's work? I think it's incredible.
Oh, it's awesome. It's amazing how, because from the correspondence from at that archive and also at Richard Barnaby's archive in Kingston in Ontario. And this all I did in 2016, 2017, and it's part of my prayer man paper.
I'm so glad. I really was chagrined by the thought that you might not have had it back then.
No, and then basically there is a triangle or maybe four corners of people that basically doing this. And that's Weisberg, Richard E. Sprague, Richard Barnaby, and also Howard Ruffman is to a certain extent involved.
Happened to Howard?
He did merchandise at Star Wars.
For Lucas, for George Lucas.
Right.
Yeah.
We're thinking of reaching out to him. He's still alive. He's a relatively young man.
He was in his early 20s when he was working with Weisberg.
Yeah, right. No, he got very active in the gay community as well. He's done a lot. He's done incredible photography of gay men.
Yeah.
From
that correspondence, I got more to read about from Richard Barnaby to Richard E. Sprague as well. And Sprague shared a lot of valuable information regarding his talks and his captures of material from, what do you call them? I was going to say news agencies, but the networks back then, basically. So he managed to get, I think, Couch for $60. And from ABC, and he said ABC were no problem, but NBC had just had the door shut.
Yeah.
And NBC has Wiegman and Donnell. So
the Wiegman.
Yeah. The
Wiegman and correspondence, ARP had lots of correspondence with NBC.
How do you spell Barnaby's name?
B-E-R-N-A-B-E-I.
B-E-R-N-A. B-E-I, and he's out in Ontario, Canada?
Kingston,
uh-huh. And he's got a lot of good stuff.
There's some of it. I've got a a finder's aid, and also they scanned in the slides for me, and I had somebody do that over there. And then I also managed to get a lot of paperwork. And then I know also Dennis Morissette, he went there, I think, about a couple of years ago. And he scanned in a lot of correspondence associated with his iPhone, which I still have to plow through. There's tons of stuff in there. But from Barnaby, basically, the best material I got at that time was he had pretty good copies of Wiedemann. And then from the correspondence, I basically found out that Wiedemann started doing a calculation of which generation film he had. And then he bought the film from Fox Metroton, and he cut 3 frames out of that film, and he had a professional photographer reproduce them. And these are 5x4 inch, and they're at the archives. So, and I got flatbed scan copies of them. And they're, to me, especially for Prayer Man, is the best copy that's around at this point. So the hunt for me is still on, like, where's that damn film that must be in some cardboard box on some shelf somewhere. So
you're not talking about Prayer Man now. You're talking about...
Yeah, I was talking about Prayer Man, yeah.
Well, I've been leaning on the sixth floor trying to get them to let us have a first generation copy of what they've got. Isn't what they've got pretty darn good?
I have seen people trying to look at Prayer Man, but they aren't really qualified to go through this. You can go in there and you can sit there for 8 hours and you can play that movie. They won't give you a copy though. But then again, they never do to anyone because, you know, it's always copyright this, that, and the other. It's only when you come in with money. So they won't give that to researchers.
No, I know. I mean, to me, it's one of the great scandals. I think there should be a campaign to force them to cough it up. You know, that might be something we talk about at a later day.
Yeah, well, they have to go legal. That's definitely. You have to go.
Who holds the copyright? NBC to this day, or Darnell, or who?
NBC.
Yeah.
So
NBC should be leaned on.
Those films went towards New York quite quickly.
Yeah.
So, and you know, there's something else I really want to see is the material they have of at CBS for that documentary. That's such a piece of crap about all these guys being interviewed. The Warren Report, it's called, I think, and I think it was Walter Cronkite introducing it, and then have all these Texas School Book Depository black guys in there and stuff like that. And I read a story that Mark Lane and somebody else went in there and one day managed to go through all this stuff, and the second day the access was revoked as such. And then they saw a lot of things that weren't really kosher.
I believe that's true. I keep wondering about that NBC copyright business, though. I mean, it seems to me if anything would be fair use, you know, it would be that.
After all this time.
It's absurd.
I gotta, Bill, I have to find some of the agreements, here's the NBC agreement. It's actually on Mary Farrell.
The agreement between NBC and the Sixth Floor?
And ARB.
And ARB.
Yeah.
That's so weird. I mean, you know, we could use issues like this as something, possibly in this battle this year, because what good is it to have these documents released if they're not released to the American people, you know? And the Prayer Man photo is a perfect example of that, isn't it?
I mean, they had to do a privilege log.
That's just fucking crazy. I mean, fair use has got to come in play somewhere.
So,
find out if it's Oswald or not. You
know? They actually sued NBC, and then this was a settlement.
Yeah.
NBC stuck to its guns and the ARB sued them. The United States did.
Yeah, but, you know, we should still have fair use ability, quite apart from the fucking copyright. You know?
If Prayer Man is Oswald, the whole deck of cards tumbles.
Falls down, so.
All of it.
But all of it. Not us wasting our time, you know, millions of hours of going into this simple question while there's many other things to battle as well, you know. And this seems upside down to me. Yeah. Copyright or no copyright?
It has to be the will. That's the whole thing.
That's right.
And without the will, we're going to be
crushed.
Yeah, well, not just that. Also, we just won't reach anything or anyone. So that's why I'm hunting for a better copy, even if it's second generation.
Well, what bothers me, guys, is, okay, when I first went to the Texas Scuba Depository Museum, 6-4 Museum, it was in 91. I think it was 91 was the first time I ever went there. And you couldn't take photographs upstairs on the 6th floor. You couldn't record any of the videos.
Yeah, and they had the corner there glassed off, but they still have it like that.
Yeah, and it was always stated that the reason why you couldn't do that was because copyright. That was their big thing. They had signs posted, because of copyright, you can't take any photographs. I still took photographs while I was up there of the 6th floor, you know, corner window and stuff. Yeah, I took them with covert
it's
cameras.
It's illegal, as far as I'm concerned, to bar you from taking photographs.
Bill, have you seen it?
Have you seen it? There.
No, please send it to me, Larry.
Okay. Yeah, Larry, I'll have that too, please.
Yeah, you can put it up.
Bill, you want to check your email? I sent you that chart.
Oh,
look at D, Bart. Look at D.
Hold on.
And I updated the routing.
D, the Dorman. Oh, good. Yeah, Elsie Dorman. Yeah.
Yeah.
Larry, send us a copy of that to the Project K Yahoo website or email.
I
really want to read this.
Oh.
Well, the thing is now when you go up there to the 6th floor, you can go in there and take photographs of everything that's on display. You can stand there with a video camera and video record the films that are playing. And you can even buy the films down in the gift shop. So I was sitting there going, okay, if it was such a big thing, you know, copyright issues 20 years ago, 30 years ago, what the hell's changed now? Where, okay, you're now allowing everything to be photographed upstairs. You know, you're not taking people's cell phones anymore.
Yeah, I guess it's almost everybody's dead now. That's the difference.
Yeah.
You know?
But the point is, I mean, if they can allow that, why can't we go into the archives at the school, at the 6th floor museum, and actually get copies of this stuff? You know, like you said, it should be under fair use, and we should be able to get copies of it.
Bill, here's the settlement agreement with the lawsuit.
Fantastic. You mailing it to me, or you?
Yeah, I'll email it to you. This was all Mary Farrell. When you get into that, you have to go deep into the ARB documents.
The ARB documents. I'm still exploring that area. It's a new area to me.
Yeah.
Great stuff. Anyway, and I got your chart, Larry. Great. That's also a fine piece of work. You got the important people lined up there. I mean, that's half the battle.
Well, great stuff, guys. Great stuff.
Yeah. Very great session.
You know, I might end by saying the last time I had students and took them up to the 6th floor museum, I was escorted out by the police.
I was with you.
Because I was I gave a speech in front of the 6th floor window there, and I just told them, basically, I was talking to my students and I got a little louder and I drew attention to everybody around, and then the security people started coming around, and I basically said, see this window right here, see this area that's cordoned off. I said, everything is exactly the way it was that day. And I said, we're trying to be, correct in everything that we do. And I said, look, the boxes are in the correct spot. And I got a little louder and I said, look at the boxes around that window. The window's open halfway. And I said, and Oswald still isn't there. At least they could have put a cutout of Oswald standing there with the rifle or kneeling there with the rifle. But I said, it is in perfect shape exactly the way it was on November 22nd, 1963. And two of the officers came up and said, would you like to go outside the room? And I said, yeah, I'll walk out with you.
So, Bill, you see, notice that CBS donated this material.
CBS?
NBC had to go into litigation.
I don't see it yet. You emailed it to me?
No, no, I'm having it on the screen, the sharing.
On the screen, I'm sorry. Okay.
Yeah. Can you see it?
Shift. I'm struggling here. I'm sorry. There it is. Yeah, I see it.
So, and that's the term, deed of gift.
Yep.
And that's what goes out to the archives to colleges and universities, correct?
Yep.
Okay.
So CBS made a deed of gift. What did NBC do? Did NBC not do a deed of gift?
They had a settlement agreement, and there's provision to the terms of how you can, you know, what they're allowing them to use.
Okay.
This is a gift. Amazing.
Horrifying.
All right, well, anything else, or are we going to bring it to a close, guys?
It's been fun.
All right, well, with that, like I say, the next meeting will be posted on the website for May 15th for the Journey meeting. The conference is going to be April 30th, May 1st, May 2nd. Speakers, you get in free. Everybody else, your tickets are available. You can purchase them now. And with that, we're going to bring the Journey meeting number 4 to a close.
Great.
I just want to thank you guys for being in attendance and sharing great information.
I just wanted to ask Bill if he had ever been made aware of the Newcomb tapes that were done by that was done by Fred Newcomb for his book Murder from Within.
I've got Murder from Within. I haven't seen or heard the Newcomb tapes. Maybe you can tell me about them online.
I have them.
Wow. That's a big deal.
That was a big part of the book, of my book. In fact, it's the main thesis, the main chapter. Yeah. And I'll send you, I have a Dropbox. I have one of those, because the files are quite large.
Uh huh.
And I've only shared them with a small group of serious researchers, and I also did the transcripts for those 7 years ago, and they're quite revealing about what really happened on Elm Street there.
Oh, I'd really appreciate it. That would be great. Whatever you can do.
All right. So I'll send you the link.
Thank you.
All right.
I'm sorry, can I just ask one small question? I may have missed it, but when is the schedule of all the speakers, et cetera, names?
The speakers, the scheduled times will all be posted. I'm hoping I'll have everything posted Monday morning or sometime Monday afternoon. So,
all right, thank you.
Check on the website under the events tab, and you'll see the list of speakers and the list of schedules.
Okay,
and
cool.
When one very last thing, I just found on Mary Farrell, there's a deed of gift for Tom Allier's footage.
Yep.
Sweet.
Yeah. I've got a handwritten document by him and with the ARB, and they took the film off him in exchange for a copy. So he got a copy for himself, but the original went to the ARB.
That was the result. There was a lot of back and forth with his employer before that was done.
Fascinating.
Yeah, and the Cook film is another one. I really want a good digital copy of the NARA has got that as well, and the Cook film is based mostly footage around the Texas School Book Depository when the cops are arriving and the employees of the Texas School Book Depository are all standing outside and so forth.
It's really a shame that ARB was allowed to dissolve because they had so much power. I mean, I know they were extended twice, but they did such a – when you go through the files and you see what they did, you know, the report itself was full of nuggets, but when you start reading the memos and the memos to the files – memorializing the conversations they're having, and particularly with the Secret Service.
A new one is going to start for the lynching cases in the United States in the next.
Really?
Year. Yeah, the laws passed. Stuart Wexler's students helped get it passed.
Right.
Trump signed it, and now they're in the middle of trying to get their board picked. And so in that context, you know, if we care about it enough and think it's important enough, we could lobby for another ARB or something like it.
Well, that may be something that we, when we get to the public hearing for the PIDB, and if we ever get a congressional oversight hearing, you know, unless they give NARA that authority, but NARA doesn't have the resources, unless they give them.
You want those kind of five people, you know, and a small staff to get it done right and efficiently. That's the way to get it done.
Because, I mean, you know, I know there's a lot of questions about gun, but the staff, you know, what's her name?
First rate.
I mean, what was her name? I mentioned to you yesterday. The attorney. Joan Zimmerman, fabulous. I mean, she was like tenacious. And if she didn't like what she would write a file, memo to the file, and then they would, you know, start pursuing them. But that's what we need.
Yeah. I mean, if January 6th ever is going to have a real investigation, it's the same model. You don't want these commissions. They're a waste of time.
Right. Exactly.
All right, guys.
Okay.
Hey, Sue Wexler and Larry Hancock will be at our conversation on the convention April 30th, May 1st, May 2nd. So that most of them, I think they're going to talk about Martin Luther King, but I'm sure that Stu may bring up some of the material that you guys just focused in on.
I hope he does.
Bart and Bill and David, I just sent you the copies of those agreements.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you, guys.
All right, have a good weekend.
All right, you guys take care. Thanks again.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.